Welcome to this special Think Tank edition of Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. We gathered 8 clinical investigators, including co-chairperson Dr. Tom Lynch, to debate and discuss the most important new clinical research data sets in the field and to present patients from their practices and also respond to questions and cases sent to our CME group from oncologists in practice. To begin, we discussed a case sent from Dr. Ken Huffman in community practice in Teaneck, New Jersey, who asked for feedback on a challenging case of a 71-year-old man who smoked 2 packs of cigarettes a day with a 4-centimeter lesion in the left upper lobe abutting the fissure. 9 months ago, the patient had coronary bypass surgery with a protracted post-op course of osteomyelitis of the sternum, and the patient adamantly refused surgery for the pulmonary lesion. Dr. Huffman was interested in non-surgical options in this situation, including stereotactic radiation therapy, and Dr. Harvey Pass began the discussion.
I think we're going to see more of this. And the use of non-surgical therapies, the surgeons are going to have to understand about too. I personally feel that a patient like this that says to you, I absolutely will not be operated on, who has retained function, is one that you can mention surgery to, but he wants to know what other stuff you've got. So what I will literally talk about first of all, and I'm lucky to have it, is our protocol, which is a national protocol now through Radiation Therapy Oncology Group, 0618, in which we are looking at the role of stereotactic body radiation therapy in resectable patients. These are patients that have to have lesions like this gentleman. I think you said it was 4 centimeters. It was sort of peripheral, that can be in the peripheral zone, not the central zone, and would then receive 3 doses of 20 gray, usually 1 a week or can be once every 3 days, in a very, very fixed way, using a cradle, using real QA through RTOG, so that you can make sure you're delivering the 60 gray to the lesion. And the difference with this is that it's based on resectable patients as opposed to the previous trials that were based on unresectable patients done by Bob Timmerman.
Now, this is a one-arm study?
This is a one-arm study, is a feasibility study to see whether you can do it. In fact, it's only open to 35 patients, and the accrual now is up to about 16. So we're getting there. And after a slow accrual, all of a sudden it's picked up. And so once we can show control, what's the intermediate endpoint of a trial like this? Well, you want to show local control. You want to show that you have better than 90% local control at 2 years with this type of treatment.
Tom, what about the issue of the other parts of the team, particularly medical oncologists involved with the local therapy decision? Do oncologists ever see these kinds of patients?
I think they're seeing more of them as time goes on, I think, for the point that you raise. But I think that the point that Harvey made about increasing numbers of patients looking for non-operative approaches to non-small cell lung cancer is certainly a trend I've observed in my practice and evaluating people with early stage disease. And I think increasingly we're going to have to become more comfortable with making recommendations about non-operative approaches to lung cancer.
Tony, what about the issue of adjuvant therapy in this situation? Obviously, you don't really have the pathology. Would you consider that in this kind of a situation?
It depends on the patient, clinical setting of the patient. I mean, in someone who has comorbidities, no, I wouldn't go up that far out on the limb. Someone who's very healthy and has a T2 lesion, I'd probably consider that as, again, an off-study situation after speaking with the patient. I'd probably consider it after, like, stereotactic radiotherapy.
Mark?
Now, one issue, Harvey, this RTOG trial, I assume this is in node-negative patients.
That is correct.
And what are the criteria for establishing the negativity of the nodes? Because that's not a perfect science.
That is not a perfect science. That's exactly correct. And in fact, obviously, everybody gets a PET scan.
Right.
Obviously, everybody has a peripheral lesion. But obviously, you come back to the conventional wisdom that if you have a peripheral lesion, you have between a 5 and 10% chance that you're going to have some nodes somewhere, even if the PET scan is negative.
Right.
Now, the RTOG has bought that, but if an individual center says we're not comfortable with just PET in this situation and we want to do a complete workup, a mediastinoscopy, and to make sure before I put the patient on the trial, besides having a biopsy of the tissue itself, then that's also allowed. But PET becomes the, quote, standard at this point.
I'm going to come back to you in a second, Harvey, and ask you what's happened in terms of local therapy that they really need to know about. And I'll say including surgeons, not just med oncs. But before I do, I want to bring in another case, which is your case, Rogerio.
Okay. So this is a 68-year-old Hispanic female, previously healthy, who was found to have a right upper lobe mass after coming to her physician with complaints of a persistent cough and progressive chest pain. Her preoperative imaging studies showed a 4.5 centimeter mass in the right upper lobe attached to the pleura, which was hypermetabolic on PET with a max SUV of 12.
Before you go on, maybe we'll turn to Harvey for some initial follow-up. What was her smoking history?
She had a 50-year pack history of smoking.
So she was currently smoking?
She was smoking up until the time of her diagnosis. By the time I saw her, she had stopped 2 or 3 weeks cold turkey.
So any other information in terms of the local management decision, in terms of imaging and other workups she had prior to the time that the surgeons made a decision about what to do?
So we talked about her CT scan, her PET scan. She had PFTs that showed only mild obstructive disease.
So, Harvey, what would you be thinking in this situation in terms of the next step?
Well, the first thing is that Rogerio said the magic word. I mean, the magic word is pain, which high SUV, very active lesion, pain in this patient, peripheral lesion. This patient has a T3 lesion. This patient has chest wall pain. This patient, the surgeon must immediately think about the margins and a chest wall resection potentially for this patient, and will this patient be able to tolerate it? Where is the lesion located? Is it lateral? Is it anterior? How good are the pulmonary function tests? Can the patient tolerate having a 3 or 4 rib chest wall resection on block? And the next question is the mediastinum really negative? Does the surgeon really look at the PET scan himself to make sure and convince himself? And if the PET scan is completely negative, 4 centimeters, then you could argue that this is a T3N0. Should you primarily resect this lesion, telling the patient that you're going to probably do a chest wall resection, but you got to know what it is also. You could argue that you could, if you were on protocol, you could refer that to your medical colleagues and say, maybe this patient should get some induction. Maybe this patient should have a biopsy, show what's going on. But then there's the controversy that has been brewing that we've heard also at ASCO with regard to, is induction the way to go or is postoperative adjuvant the way to go? But these are all central current issues that need to be taken into with a high SUV, 4 centimeter lesion, which is not a small lesion.
Mark,
would you stage the mediastinum?
Yeah.
I would stage the mediastinum in this case.
What type of mediastinoscopy?
It's a right-sided lesion. I would do a standard mediastinoscopy. I mean, my standard mediastinoscopy gets 2, 4R, 4L, as well as 7. So I'm looking at the levels on the other side, meaning 4L.
Enough thoracoscopically or surgically?
I do that. It depends upon the size of the lymph nodes. We also have endobronchial ultrasound, and we have real-time endobronchial ultrasound, which means that we can actually see the needle come out in the lymph node. If I have a PET-positive mediastinum, if I have a very large lymph node that's not PET-positive, that I'm sure I'm going to be able to hit, then I will use EBUS to try to avoid mediastinoscopy.
Rogerio, bring us up to date in terms of when you first saw the patient. What happened from that point to when you saw the patient?
I saw the patient post-op. So the workup was done, in fact, at an outside institution, not at our own hospital. So she did not have a bronchoscopy, much less an EBUS. She didn't even have a preoperative biopsy.
But she had a mediastinoscopy.
So she went to the surgeon who did a thoracoscopic mediastinoscopy, mm-hmm. found the mediastinal nodes to be negative, and in the same procedure took the right upper lobe out.
Harvey, you agree with not biopsying prior to surgery?
I think that that's controversial. Depends upon, you know, I'm a protocol guy. I mean, if this is a patient who doesn't fit any protocols and has an SUV of 12 and has a negative mediastinum, which I would not do video thoracoscopically, then I don't think you need to have a biopsy on this patient. You can easily find out what it is at the time of the operation. But the approach is different. I mean, I would be very, very concerned to start out video assisted on this patient and then have to deal with a lesion that's potentially invading the chest wall. What do you do about those deep margins? I mean, it's unusual that you have the thoracic surgeon who does VATS, chest wall resection, mm-hmm. and lobectomy.
So what actually happened at surgery, and what did they see?
So the tumor was attached to the pleura, but was not invading into the chest wall. She had a
Which pleura? Visceral or parietal?
Parietal pleura.
Parietal.
She had an uncomplicated postoperative course, and her final pathology showed a 4.2 centimeter poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma, vascular invasion. It was abutting, but not invading through the pleura. One positive hilar node, negative mediastinal nodes. So her final stage was a T2N1 stage 2B.
What kind of physical and mental condition was this woman in when you saw her?
So by the time I saw her, she was feeling better. She was recovering from the surgery.
Still not feeling back to herself?
No, obviously
not. It was
not.
About how long was it?
It was about 3 weeks.
3 weeks. Still having a fair amount of pain?
Did she have a complete VATS approach for Giroux?
Yes.
She did. That's interesting.
So, I mean, because there was a paper we asked you to review where it didn't look like there was that much difference in the way I read the paper in VATS versus non-VATS in terms of pain and stuff. Is that true?
I think that that's a very good point, Neil. I mean, first of all, the paper that we did review, which was a systemic review and meta-analysis of all the papers that talked about this, was a very selected group of papers. It was 516 to begin with, and then it came down to 21. And what were the endpoints that were looked at? Well, pain was not one of them, because they couldn't get the data, really, from that. So you have to be wary of analysis like this, although...
But I mean, have individual studies shown less pain?
Yes. Individual studies have shown less pain, and also it depends upon what type of a VATS you're talking about. VATS, in the true sense of the word, meaning a VATS lobectomy complete, means that you never spread the ribs, that you actually are using a very small access incision, using very small ports, and the procedure is done without rib spreading. And when you do it that way, then usually the patients, as a surgeon who's been in the business for a while, you see a remarkable difference in these patients. You see a remarkable difference in the postoperative chest x-ray. The chest x-ray looks different. It looks like they never got operated
on. What about time in the hospital? Because there it didn't look that different.
Yes, but also if you look at other papers that are individual institutional trials, there's a very recent paper from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Group in which they looked at matched patients, lobectomy standard versus VATS lobectomy, true VATS lobectomy, you see a decrease in length of time in the hospital. You see a trend toward decreased complications. So I think it depends upon the individual expertise and what type of VATS is performed. And in fact, going to the issue of getting ready for systemic therapy or adjuvant therapy after VATS, there's papers and literature from Scott Swanson that says that patients who have VATS, you have a higher percentage of patients because they have less pain, they recover quicker, that will then move on to the idea of adjuvant therapy.
Tom, how would you be thinking through this situation and what kinds of options on protocol or off protocol might you be thinking about?
Well, she has a 4.5 centimeter lesion.
And poorly differentiated vascular
differentiated
lesion.
And she had one node positive. So,
What kind of tissue biomarkers would you like to see?
She's a smoker. So what we would do on protocol in a research standpoint is this would be a patient who we would profile using the snapshot array that we're looking at, which is approximately 50-55 mutations, including most prominently EGFR and RAS. Although I must say in this patient, the odds that they have an EGFR mutation is low.
What would it be?
I think it's less than 1% and a heavy smoker, like this woman who was smoking up until the time of presentation. So I think it's unlikely she has an EGFR mutation. I'm not certain, Neil, that molecular profiling will give me extraordinary benefit today with this patient. I think we may find in patients like this that there is a pattern that helps guide therapy in the future, which is one of the reasons I think we should be doing it as part of routine research collection of data. But in a patient like this, I'm going to be very persuaded that I think adjuvant chemotherapy would help her. I would move toward a cisplatin. Unlike my colleague, Dr. Greco, I would move toward a cisplatin-based therapy with her. I think you probably could pick whatever your favorite cisplatin doublet is and give it for four cycles.
Any options on trial at your place?
She'd be eligible for the intergroup study, which randomizes patients to cisplatin-based chemotherapy versus cisplatin chemotherapy plus bevacizumab. It's a difficult trial to talk to patients about, and it's a challenging trial, I think, for patients to consider because of the substantial potential toxicities of Bev, not necessarily the real toxicities of Bev. But I've found that trial difficult, and accrual has been somewhat slow. I guess one of the questions that I'd be interested in what people think, one of the questions that you raised is how has the perception of the adjuvant colon study from ASCO impacted how well we were not recruiting well to the intergroup study before ASCO. And so has there been any fall off since ASCO, or even maybe some people have viewed the colon study as more positive than they thought and hasn't necessarily picked up?
How many patients, if any, have you put on that study, Tom?
I personally have not put anyone on that trial.
So do you think your gut would be you might not even bring it up to this woman?
No, I would bring it up to this woman because I think it's actually a reasonable thing to bring up to this woman. My reason for not putting anyone in the trial was that it took about a year and a half to get through our IRB at Mass General, and it's still going through the
Why
IRB
is that?
At Yale. What's happening, Neil, I think one of the things I'm curious what other people think is the bureaucratic difficulty of getting studies through review committees.
So it wasn't this study. That's just what happened there?
No, it's just a difficult.
A year and a half to get a major study?
It was about a year and a half to get that through, yes.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's not good.
No.
Tony, for the adjuvant Bev colon study that was reported at the plenary session at ASCO, they reported that in the first year, while their patients were on the Bev, there was a 40% reduction in relapse. But by the time, just as they got to 3 years, it became non-significant. Norm Wallmark from the podium suggested repeating the study with a 2 or 3 year duration of Bev. What was your take on this biologically, clinically, and what, if any, relevance do you think this has to lung cancer?
Well, I think it's a powerful study. It had several thousand patients in this trial.
2,700 in 2 years were put on.
Yeah, a little more than
2,700 in 2 years.
Yeah, a little more than 1,300 per arm. So I think that kind of power is important. And it's a negative study when looking, as you mentioned, at 3 years. There's no difference in disease-free survival. And the bevacizumab simply didn't add to the therapy. Now, yes, there was some early improvement in that arm, but I don't think it's clinically relevant. Is it biologically important? First of all, and I know everyone in this room, probably everyone in the world knows, these tumors are not the same. Let's face it. I mean, breast, lung, colorectal, there are differences. There are general principles that I think are the same. Namely, I think it makes sense to, quote, use adjuvant therapy in patients who have high risk for relapse in lung, in breast, in colorectal, in small cell, in Ewing sarcoma. I could go on and on. And in fact, the data would support that I'm correct. However, the individual therapies we're using don't necessarily translate into the various tumor types. Now, I could give several reasons, but it's all theoretical. Some were given at this presentation. Others have thought of why doesn't bevacizumab work in this setting when it works in, quote, metastatic disease? And I'm not going to speculate there. I'll let others talk about that because I don't think we know.
I want to ask John, because actually I didn't realize when I was looking through his bio that he mentored with Judah Folkman. And we were talking last night about, you know, theoretically, what would you expect of something like Bev in the adjuvant settings? Is there a biologic reason? How does Bev actually work? Yeah. What were your thoughts on this?
It's a great question. And I think one way to interpret the colon data is it's entirely consistent with what we think the mechanism of the drug would be. And in a way, it's a shame it wasn't designed differently. And by that, I mean the following. When we give adjuvant chemotherapy, the goal is to wipe out micrometastatic disease. And we know we have some success with that, say a 30% reduction in disease coming back. The goal of bevacizumab in this setting, or angiogenesis inhibitors in general, is to promote tumor dormancy, would be the term that Folkman used. This goes back to the original New England Journal Review, where the idea of angiogenesis inhibition was first proposed. The idea was that micrometastatic disease can be dormant unless it acquires blood vessels. The cancer cells don't go away. They're still viable. They just don't have a blood supply. And if you can cut off the blood supply or prevent it from growing, they'll stay micrometastatic. But if you stop the inhibition, they can start growing again. So if you think of that as a mechanism, and I'll tell you that in the laboratory when we test this, that's exactly what happens. Is you can have a tumor be dormant, but then you take away the drug and it grows happily. So in that context, unlike adjuvant chemotherapy where you give it and it's given, here one would want to continue the drug, and if you stop the drug, it would be expected that the tumors would start growing again. So I think the idea of repeating it with a longer duration of bevacizumab is rational in this case. I think there's a lot of cases where people argue for redoing a study.
But is it rational?
I think I'm getting at what Mark said. It is irrational because it would really, to some extent, imply indefinite Bev.
Right.
There are some analogies. This is not dissimilar from melanoma, where as long as interferon's on board, you show benefit of melanoma not coming back.
It's not that much different than hormone therapy of breast cancer, where now we're doing trials of 10 versus 5.
Right. I don't think the target is specific enough. I mean, trastuzumab produces a remarkable improvement in survival in selected appropriate patients. You don't give it forever. You give it for a relatively short period of time. The Europeans only gave it for a year.
Well, Mark, you know, what's kind of surprised me, and it was reflected at that symposium, is people were more focused on the practical issues of giving Bev for 2 or 3 years, the cost, the toxicity, things like that. But to me, in terms of biologic message, I mean, maybe we come up with a pill. You know, you've done work with sunitinib. Right. Maybe you come up with something that works better, is less toxic, that you could really give for 5 years.
Well, I mean, getting back to what I was reflecting on this when Tom was talking, one of the biggest pushbacks we've had on the adjuvant ECOG trial with bevacizumab is the difference between getting 4 cycles in treatment for a year. You know, adjuvant therapy is supposed to be of short duration. It either does it or it doesn't do it. This concept that patients don't want to be randomized to something that is for 12 weeks versus a year.
Yeah, but and I that's mean, been a people but, went into but, the Herceptin studies without
right.
any problem. They
yeah.
got
no,
it for
no,
a year.
No, but I think, you know, we talked about this at that ASCO thing. And the issue is that, you know, I don't think any of us are willing to dismiss the concept that targeting angiogenesis in the adjuvant setting is a good idea. Bev may not be the best drug to do that because of the nature of the drug. There may be other approaches.
John?
To give two other counterexamples, I guess, if you think about if we had done the breast cancer tamoxifen adjuvant studies for 1 year and they showed a strong trend and gave them up there, you know, obviously we'd be losing the benefit from that drug.
So right. No, I'm
although
not, yeah.
there were trials, and so they showed a year tamoxifen worked.
Yeah,
and
that's
and then
correct.
There was 2 versus 1, 5 versus 2, 10 versus 5.
Right. I guess the question is, if the benefit you see over 1 year is acceptable, if that 40% reduction is considered a magnitude of benefit that we would consider clinically meaningful, and we would expect that to continue, that's what should guide whether those trials happen. Now, there's expense issues, there's toxicity issues, and so forth. We may be able to do better with other approaches,
right.
but we certainly wouldn't want to throw out the baby with the
bathwater. No, I just said I don't think any of us are willing to dismiss that as a testable paradigm in the adjuvant setting. But again, an IV drug every 3 weeks may not be the best way to go about that.
So I want to actually find out what happened with the patient. But first, Ron, at your place, this patient presents. What would you be thinking, off protocol? And are there any protocol? Do you participate in the ECOG study?
Oh, I would hope to enroll this patient in a protocol. We have 2 clinical trials. One is a vaccine trial, the Magritte study, and it competes directly with the Radiant trial, in which we look at EGFR expression. When patients have tumors that express both the MAGE antigen and are EGFR positive, and that does happen on occasion, there is some overlap, we favor the MAGE protocol because it's a vaccine trial. It's tougher to accrue to. Only about 30% or so of patients with stage 2 disease actually express the antigen, so we would favor that. And both studies, fortunately, allow patients to receive standard platinum-based adjuvant chemotherapy and then are randomized either to receive erlotinib or placebo for a 2-year period or to receive the vaccine or vaccine injections for a defined period of time.
So in a patient like this, what would be the likely chemo you might choose?
I would probably favor a widely used standard cisplatin vinorelbine, or although with a poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma, now I'd more likely use cisplatin pemetrexed.
Anybody use carbo, as Tony is continuing to do in the adjuvant setting? And we know, Tony, that you are in a minority based on our patterns of care studies with the investigators, but you're not with the docs in practice because that's their number one choice. So that does seem to be changing, Vince.
You know, we do see occasional patients like the type Tony sees every day. And you'll have someone with a real high-risk tumor who's deaf or has a creatinine that is borderline, and you'll feel compelled that they would benefit from something. And you'll give them carbo and agent X, which you might have used with the cyst in other cases.
And I think if you ask the thought leaders and the academics, half of my patients are still getting carbo adjuvant.
Yeah, okay. I think half may be too high. I mean, I think if the choice comes down to no adjuvant chemo versus a carbo-based doublet, most people here will say, I'll use the carbo.
Yeah.
But you if
know,
you think you can get
but
the
if
cis
you think
in.
You can get the cis in, you know, I think most people would say that that would be our first option.
Yeah, but I still think there's a lot of carbo because of the nature of the population.
I use a lot of carbo in the adjuvant setting. I try to be selective about it. And half of the carbo that I use in the adjuvant setting are patients that I gave first cycle cisplatin to.
The other drug is as important as the platinum. The other drug, for some reason, you can just pick a whole bunch of them, and there's no data on any of them except vinorelbine. So, see, this is inconsistency for me. I think in this type of patient, the pemetrexed, Ron mentioned this, makes a lot more sense as the other drug. Again, there's no data yet to prove that, but extrapolation is the order of the day in oncology and all of medicine. You don't have data for everything, but you still have to treat patients.
Let's find out what happened
with
the patient.
So what happened is pretty much what Tom outlined. So I first made a case for the need for adjuvant chemo and went over the numbers and probabilities for relapse, et cetera. Then discussed ECOG 1505. And the issue of bevacizumab in addition to chemo and the different regimens.
And when was this that the discussion
this
occurred?
This was at the, she was my third patient on trial, so.
About how long ago was that?
About a year and a half.
And so, what kind of chemo were you thinking about?
In her case, obviously pemetrexed was not an option at that time. And she said she did not want to lose her hair. That was her one and very specific request.
Had she heard a lot about chemo and known anyone close to her who'd received it?
She didn't have anybody close to her, but she had the typical idea about chemo and what it would do and the nausea, et cetera. But hair loss was a big issue for her. So I picked cis gemcitabine, a choice that I probably would not make today.
You'd give her cis pem?
Pemetrexed, probably.
And how did she feel about the study?
And, you know, I think the patient herself, as in the rest of the discussion, didn't express any strong feelings about being on a study or not being on a study. She understood, however, that she needed some additional treatment, so she was willing to have adjuvant treatment. The issue, as Mark pointed out, and since then it's been my number one issue, is the duration of the bevacizumab. So the fact that they have to go beyond four cycles for a whole year of Bev has been the single most important reason for patients turning down this protocol. I have not been very lucky with the study. It's not the colon data so much. At least it hasn't really reached the patients so much in the past 2 months or a month or so. But the fact that they have to stay on Bev for 12 months is just not appealing.
So this patient went into the study?
She consented to the study, and she was actually randomized to the Bev arm.
And how did she do?
She was my first patient on the Bev arm. The other patients were all on non-Bev.
How did she do?
She did okay. I mean, she had, I think, hematologic toxicity that was moderate. I had to delay one of her cycles. And I think, based on the protocol, I dose reduced her for subsequent cycles. But she finished the four cycles.
Any Bev
and
problems?
No Bev problems.
Proteinuria?
Nothing.
Nosebleeds?
Nope. I mean, I have patients who complain of nosebleeds every single visit. I mean, this patient, I don't recall.
We hear that
a
lot from oncologists and being described as like a nuisance and not a major problem, but I've heard more about that in terms of the frequency.
You hear patients saying, you know, that it takes 10 minutes for that nosebleed to stop, and some of them have to go to the emergency room. I mean, I've had more issues than just a nuisance, but not this patient.
And her hair was okay?
Yeah, she was fine with her hair.
Any GI problems from the chemo?
You know, she received, you know, aggressive antiemetic therapy. I always put these patients on Decadron for 4 days after the cyst, and she did really well. I mean, it wasn't a walk in the park, but she did really well.
And now, how long has it been since she stopped the Bev?
She stopped just a few months ago.
What was her quality of life like when she was on the Bev alone compared to when she was on the Bev chemo? I mean, when she went back to Bev, was she like
almost
normal?
Bev alone was not a problem for her.
It was like normal?
It was not a problem. She would come, get the infusion. As I said, she didn't have problems with blood pressure, nosebleeds. She was just doing well.
I'd like to bring in, Vince, the work that was done at your place that you were involved with, looking at pre-op chemo, Bev. Again, looking at other tumors, breast cancer, there's a huge NSABP study looking at chemo plus or minus Bev, particularly interested in tissue biomarkers and translational work to try to figure this out. Can you talk about the work that you all did?
So the trial you're describing, Neil, is the Beacon trial that we presented at ASCO this past year. And, you know, we have a long background institutionally of being interested in preoperative chemotherapy in this setting. And we have some good internal data on whether we might see a signal of enhanced activity. I mean, we had data from Kathy Pister's 15 years ago that if you continued a cisplatin-based induction regimen over about 11 weeks, you saw a path CR rate of about 15%. So we've sort of kept that in mind as we look at new regimens. But the thesis of this, of course, was that bevacizumab really has increased response rate at the very least in multiple trials in advanced lung cancer. And so that in the neoadjuvant setting where that might be a surrogate in turn for pathologic complete response, it would be interesting to study.
And one of the things about what you did, if I read that correctly, was there was a run-in period when they just got Bev. And it kind of reminded me of what had been done by Chris Willett in rectal cancer, where the same thing happened. There was a period where they could observe what happened just with Bev. So can you talk about basically what was seen?
Yeah, I think it would be great to get John's input on mechanistics here, but the thesis has been that bevacizumab by itself doesn't have single agent activity in lung cancer. And certainly in the rigorous sense, perhaps for, you know, WHO PRs and things, it may not, but we got patients a scan on day one. We gave them a dose of Bev. We rescanned them 2 weeks later. And as you can see from the waterfall plot in there, by bidimensional or volumetrics, almost all the patients had a reduction in tumor volume. That is, that tumor cell, is it interstitial edema? We don't know what it represents per se, but things would get smaller. And the error bars in those are very small in the volumetric CTs that Larry Schwartz does. So I do believe that. I just don't know the clinical implications.
I'm sure you've all seen that. It's an amazing waterfall plot. John, what do you think about that?
No, it is great to see that. And in fact, we don't have a similar experience. You know, usually it's done in the metastatic setting where we're not able to look at the tumors in the same way and see that. So it really does illustrate that the drug does have single-agent activity by itself. And I think that's a wonderful paradigm that they've been following. A similar trial is conducted in New York, and we've been involved in the biomarker analysis with the neoadjuvant pazopanib. And this was from patients that were screened as part of the screening study in which early-stage lung cancer was seen. This is routine lung cancer CTs. And in this study, early-stage lung cancer patients were treated with pazopanib for 4 to 6 weeks. So it's a similar design as the Beacon study. And there, similarly, 86% had a reduction in their tumor volume. And in some cases, it was quite large. And we've actually identified some baseline angiogenic factors that can predict who's going to respond and not respond.
And when we had our renal cell program here, John's buddy Eric Jonash was here, and he's done with John really interesting new adjuvant translational work with renal cell. But what about this issue that Vince brings up? Is this anti-tumor effect or some kind of vascular thing?
It's a great question. I think in the case of bevacizumab, you'd most strongly argue that it's a vascular effect. Now, tumor cells themselves occasionally have VEGF receptors. It's expressed most strongly in colorectal cancer. There a lot of times they have the VEGF receptor 1, which also binds VEGF, but occasionally lung cancer cells have VEGF receptor 2. In fact, if you put them in hypoxia or an acid, you can increase it, but by and large, the majority don't. So this is probably an antivascular effect, and I think it's the case that with early-stage tumors, you can see these effects in a more pronounced way. I think by the time a tumor is larger or more metastatic, it has better established vessels, and it's harder to get significant shrinkage with just bevacizumab by itself. And to illustrate this, in the randomized phase 2 bevacizumab study conducted by Dave Johnson, they had a crossover where patients who had been treated with carboplatin and paclitaxel that didn't get the bevacizumab arm, after they progressed, they went on to bevacizumab monotherapy, except that's in the refractory metastatic setting. And there, out of 19 patients, none had a partial response. Now, it's a little bit different because that wasn't volumetric measurements, and I think volumetric measurements, you actually pick up a lot of these minor responses, and I think the Memorial Sloan Kettering experience with gefitinib was also informative in that set. That was another wonderful window of opportunity in a neoadjuvant setting. But I think the Johnson study illustrated that it may matter on the stage, and early-stage disease may be more responsive. With TKIs, I'll also point out that they also can have the effect of hitting lymphatics. VEGF receptor 3 is something that drives lymphatics, and I think that's a target that we'll hopefully start paying more attention to in the near future, because not only do we want to inhibit blood vessels, we'd like to shrink the lymphatics that are draining a tumor, particularly to prevent lymphatic spread.
No one's talked about RAS in this setting, and I get asked that question by a lot of docs because of some data from Canada that suggests that patients who had RAS mutations. Vince, you've done probably as much work on this as anybody else in the country with RAS in lung cancer now. If you knew that Ruggiero's patient was a RAS mutant, would that impact what you would tell this patient?
Well, I think the body of data on RAS is in the adjuvant setting largely derived from BR10. And again, that was a subgroup analysis, albeit a prospective one, similar to what we have for ERCC1. So I think that certainly we tell them that the mutation likely predicts for a less good outcome, regardless of what therapy is or is not chosen. Although the data did not suggest a comparable benefit in RAS mutants, we do not exclude those patients or dissuade them from adjuvant therapy. And just as far as trials, Jerry Azzoli does have an adjuvant trial for patients who have completed their local regional therapy with a mutant RAS protein.
Vince, I want to go back to your Beacon study of neoadjuvant bevacizumab. Can you follow up with more of what was presented, what you think it means, and what you're doing right now?
So the first interesting observation was that Bev by itself does do something. Then the trial basically looked at two cohorts of patients, those in whom we thought it would not be safe to give bevacizumab as induction therapy, i.e. squamous cell tumors. And those individuals would get cisplatin and docetaxel, who have now amended it to cisplatin and pemetrexed for 3 cycles. And then after surgery, they could get adjuvant bevacizumab for up to a year.
Incidentally, does that switch to pemetrexed reflect in general movement at Memorial towards that and off-protocol therapy?
I think so. Certainly my practice in the non-squamous patients, you know, when they don't fit a certain genotype, is pemetrexed dominant.
So can you talk more about the data that was presented?
Yeah, so the second cohort of patients then are those who are BEV eligible, and they got three cycles. They got their first dose of BEV separate from the chemo. Then they got two cycles of BEV synchronized with the cisplatin docetaxel. And their final cycle of preoperative therapy, we excluded the bevacizumab in anticipation of a planned surgery so that there'd be less BEV on board at the time of a thoracotomy. Perhaps in large part a theoretical concern from the sense that the half-life of BEV is, you know, a few weeks, so there'd still be meaningful drug levels around at the time of surgery, although on average it's a 3 to 4 week delay from the last chemo to surgery anyway.
And I guess, Harvey, in that colon presentation, we had already seen in the colon trial pretty good safety data, not a whole lot of complications for, you know, bowel perforation, arteriovenous events. They talk a little bit about some patients getting compromised ports. You know, they didn't really have much of a problem, but that was one of the minor problems. What's your take? I mean, I don't know whether BEV's ever going to get into this setting, but how do you think in general it sits with surgery?
I think that the precautions that are taken right now are fine. In other words, I have operated on patients like this, and we've had no problems with it. And, you know, we are very careful to make sure that if they had hypertension during the therapy that it's gone. If they have proteinuria, it's gone. And usually this 3 week, you know, except for the patient anxiety, is not a big deal. And certainly the postoperative course is exactly the same as before.
Mark, when I work with a nurse who used to work with you, Ann Stiegel, she brought up this question about ports and BEV. I guess, I don't know, maybe even sunitinib, I don't know. What's your take on it right now?
No, I mean, we've had a few problems with dehiscence of port wounds and stuff. I would consider it more a minor issue. It hasn't been a major issue, at least in our experience. It's been problematic in a few patients, but no ill consequences.
So what were your conclusions, Vince? What were the key findings, you think, in the paper, and what are you doing now?
So the key findings were that the response rate, as you might have expected, is higher in the patients who got bevacizumab. You know, this is not a randomized trial, but the response rate looked substantially higher, about 50% versus about 30%. I think that the incidence of certain complications and side effects appears comparable between the two cohorts of patients.
We do think
there may be a subtle increase in the severity of certain toxicities. So we did have some patients. One of our surgeons has looked at the data, David Finley, and we feel there is a slight uptick in the severity of some of the toxicities, pulmonary hemorrhage, bronchopleural fistula. We have seen some metaport issues as an aside. I think that's a real entity, albeit rare and not catastrophic. So I think that it will be a clear need to balance what we see in, say, pathologic complete response rate, which is sort of immature but does not appear spectacular, with perhaps a subtle increase in the severity of certain toxicities. And I'll point out there was a JCO letter from one of the colorectal surgeons, Peggy Kemeny, Nancy's sister, just sort of noting the same thing in CRC, that although the frequency of side effects in BEV-treated patients appears comparable, the severity of certain ones may be subtly increased, and that bears watching.
I don't know what the difference is. I mean, certainly the volumes are increased that they would have compared to what I have, but it may be that we're operating later. But, I mean, we just haven't seen it.
How do patients respond to being involved with this kind of research?
I think patients are receptive to this. I think it's a very simple premise that we think in lung cancer, every time we've given BEV, we've generally increased response rate. I think it's probably what we'd all have pretty good unanimity on. We can debate more about survival and PFS and things. And if that's a surrogate for perhaps path CR, they'll be excited about that. I think that the bevacizumab safety data is a discussion unto itself and a challenge. But I think generally patients are receptive to hearing that there's a higher chance their cancer shrink and there might be a chance that they're more likely to be cured.
So where is Memorial right now in this kind of research? Are there trials still ongoing, neoadjuvant trials like this?
We're finishing up this study. But
are you still putting patients on this study?
Yeah, I think as John alluded to, the concept of running trials in a well-controlled setting with really well-done volumetric CTs is a very helpful one, and that's sort of been our premise in this type of thing. We have a similar trial in EGFR-mutated patients with erlotinib and chemotherapy.
What are you seeing there?
It's been hard to accrue. We recently amended the trial to put on the mutated patients rather than just never smokers. and the subset of patients have been treated, you know, very high response rates. We'll see if it translates into PATH-CR, which would really be a sine qua non for a good result.
I want to move on to EGFR and that whole story, and particularly some of the things that happened in ASCO. But before I do, let's just close out on adjuvant and neoadjuvant, you know, taking a little bit of a global step back, reflecting what I was saying before in terms of trying to move the field forward. So let's motivate the docs in practice to get involved with research in adjuvant and neoadjuvant setting, except that the major study that's out there right now doesn't sound like there's a whole lot of enthusiasm for in this room. And there are all kinds of practical problems. And what else is out there? What do you want to see done? You know, what kinds of trials should we be doing? What's being discussed right now? Or should we just focus on translational work until we find better agents? Harvey?
I'm sorry, but I think we have to learn also from the new staging system. I mean, the new staging system clearly shows that size itself is important. And we've even changed how we scale 7-centimeter tumors. So for my money, I think that we need to think about the larger tumors that may even have no lymph nodes seen or even negative mediastinoscopy and PET scans are negative except for the tumor. To me, that's a selected population of patients that I think we ought to be thinking about induction therapy. I don't know where to move elsewhere with induction therapy. I think we have to glean the data. There's gold somewhere here, I think, on induction chemotherapy.
What do you want to see studied? Just chemo or biologics? Both?
Frankly, I think that it can be both, but I think we have to choose the right population to be able to say that there's a signal here. And I think these trials that have been done are a heterogeneous mix of patients that have blended out instead of taking the patients that I think are at highest risk that need to get induction.
How many of the faculty here put patients on the 1505 study? Two of you have actually had patients. So what do we do?
So I wanted to talk about this because I think neoadjuvant chemo has been looked at for at least a decade, and I just don't think it's going to pick up significantly unless in some specific cases in which the surgeon goes back to the medical oncologist and says, you know, I really would like you to do this. It may change my surgical plan, and it may be in the patient's best interest. And you mentioned, you know, large chest wall invasions or T4 lesions or some minimal mediastinonodal disease.
Or N2 disease?
Or minimal N2 disease. I don't particularly use that approach, but I can see how that might be useful. I really think that it may be, you mentioned the fact that it may be important for tissue acquisition, so I think that's an important value of neoadjuvant chemo. I think patients that you suspect may not be able to receive adjuvant or full adjuvant chemo, and you just want to do that ahead of time, and how you exactly make that decision is not clear to most clinicians. But other than that, I just don't think it's going to be the same type of option that we have, for example, in breast cancer. I think what we need to do is move on to the clinical trials that we discussed in the adjuvant setting. You know, so Ron referred to the vaccine trial, to the Radiant trial, and we had extensive discussions about 1505. Those trials, I think, or hopefully will change the way we look at adjuvant chemo.
Right. Plus, we have the CLGB Metagene trial.
Correct.
Now open. 30506, which at the time of resection, your tumor is sent to the Duke group, where they do their metagene analysis.
So gene RT-PCR?
Yeah. So the trial is for patients less than 4 centimeters but greater than 2 centimeters. And you are randomized to observation versus chemo. And the trial is being asked to prospectively validate the metagene model, if you
will.
No
negative?
Yes.
This is 1A disease.
Yeah, 1A disease.
So what fraction of the adjuvant patients
selected
fit into
1B?
That?
Well, I don't know. David Harpold tells me that the last 9 people he operated on that he thought were eligible for this trial ended up having N1 nodes. Just a bit of bad luck. But, I mean, we see these people with 3 centimeters.
This is a discussion we haven't had, but this is another field in terms of adjuvant treatment that's growing. You know, gene signature profiles and gene profiles, how to stratify patients as far as risk. So not just in terms of prognosis, but also prediction terms of benefit from chemo. And that's an important discussion.
And SWOG is doing the ERCC1 and RRM1 trial. So we have a number of...
Which trial is that?
We have the Canadian trial, too.
What's the Canadian? I don't know.
The Canadian presented last year their gene
signature profile.
What's the ERCC prognostic? It
is headed up by Dr. Bepler, and I don't know the eligibility criteria, but basically it's a phase two, and they're looking at ERCC1 and I believe RRM1, and I don't know the exact design, but it gets back to this issue of can you use these biomarkers for predictive value in terms of what to treat these patients with. So it's really a feasibility trial. You said that we don't have a lot of enthusiasm. I think we have a pretty good adjuvant menu out there when you look at the ECOG trial, the CLGB trial, the SWOG trial.
Yeah, but I hear a lot of lukewarm. I mean, what else can you come up with that might create more enthusiasm?
Yeah. I personally think what Mark just said is the most exciting part. I personally am a believer that using the tissue right now and looking at the profiles, and ERCC1, RMM1, TS is another one that I think is of importance. I think to me that is much more appealing. But the question is, how do you do it so you get the answers quick? How do you do it on a major scale so that you don't lose patients as you're doing this? And that's where we haven't really come to grips. I mean, we have the Bepler trial, and we're going to have that done, and we're going to get some answers. But there are thousands of patients out there, and you can get stuff done. You can go to Response Genetics and get all this done if you want to. Yeah.
But I think that, you know, one point that has to be said before we end this session is that, and I like Harvey's opinion about this, is when you look at the lung cancer population in the United States, the quality of surgery that is done, and having just been through a discussion with a patient for ECOG 1505 that was motivated to go on, and then my research nurse said he did not have a station 7 lymph node sampled, so he is not eligible. There were two abstracts at ASCO this year from the University of Tennessee that said in this about 760 patient retrospective analysis, only 8% of that population met the NCCN criteria for good quality surgical resection, and nearly 80% of them would have been excluded from enrollment on the RADIANT trial because of the quality of surgery. And so this is another issue that needs to be said, is that many of these patients, you know, just had this patient that couldn't go on to the ECOG trial because there was no station 7 node sampled.
Harvey, agree?
I do agree with this. And the question becomes, where does our friends who are insurers fit into this? I mean, as surgeons, we're hearing whispers that, you know, the quality assurance issues. And very frankly, a mediastinal lymph node dissection or a sampling, proper sampling, right now in lung cancer is a quality assurance issue. And because you have to know what to do and we have to know what to tell the patients.
Right. So, Harvey, where does number of nodes stand as a quality metric?
Number of nodes is a very different idea than just sampling the right stations. So number of nodes, very nice paper at ASCO that talked about if you have four more involved, it's a bad situation. If you look at the ratio of the number of lymph nodes taken out and it's 0.4 versus the total number of lymph nodes resected, that's a prognostic situation that it's bad.
But do you think Medicare should pay for mediastinoscopy that doesn't have at least three node station sample?
That's a good question.
I think that right now we're in a situation where that can be looked at very carefully. It's not the number of nodes, it is the stations. And there are clear guidelines. And if we're hearing about that, we're going to get docked that if a patient is going to be in the hospital a day more, and that's a quality assurance issue, well, a more important quality assurance issue is the number of lymph node stations that are sampled. I'm not even talking about a dissection, I'm talking about sampled versus a dissection. Once you start doing that, and our cardiac surgeon friends, sorry, who are now doing these cases, and they're not going to get paid because they don't meet these quality assurance standards, they'll learn real quick how to do, you know, at least to look where these are. So I think that actually, if we want to spend our money the right way, we want to lobby for something, we should be lobbying that the Blues and the insurers and the payers be looking at these issues that really affect, that it's a constant problem. You start not paying people for quality assurance issues, then things will change.
There's another potential way to get, you mentioned the colon issue with an adequate number of nodes, and to there, it looks like to me they quickly addressed this problem. Mm-hmm. That went through the American College of Surgeons and the registries, where they started to come in this way, and it got discussed in tumor boards, and the message got across. My take is that's changed. In other words, prior to that, 2-3 years ago, like half the patients did not have adequate number of nodes in the community. NCCN hospitals much higher, ACOS jumped on it, everybody jumped on it and changed. Would that kind of thing work, Rogerio, with lung cancer? Are the chest surgeons or cardiovascular surgeons, do they go to tumor boards?
Yes, and that's one thing we need to emphasize to everybody else, that particularly in people with early stage disease, And if we include all the topics that we discussed here this morning, SRS, you know, versus surgery, adjuvant chemo, neoadjuvant versus adjuvant, I mean, these patients must be presented at a multimodality conference, you know, where you have the surgeon, the radiation oncologist, the medical oncologist, the pathologist, the radiologist. Otherwise, it becomes very fragmented and the patient will suffer.
I agree with you. The only problem is that we know our, you know, what's are on the line when they're going to present the postoperative pathology at our nice institutions that we are. So it works at our places. But the problems that you have is when you have to have an adjuvant consultation when a patient is operated on elsewhere. So I think that there has to be, I mean, believe me, I'm not a communist. But at the same time, when you put restrictions and controls and you have a real evidence-based phenomenon on it, I think you're going to be able to then have a better production.
There isn't a breast cancer patient in the United States that would get a recommendation from an oncologist without knowing the pathologic status of the regional lymph nodes. But we do that in lung cancer all the time.
Hey, there's not a patient who doesn't have HER2 in ER, but what fraction of patients who get surgery have EGFR mutations?
No. Right.
Ron?
The practical issue in adjuvant therapy to the medical oncologist is that when I see a patient who's had surgery in the community where there's been an obviously inadequate mediastinal lymph node sampling, there are some thoracic surgeons who don't even know the mediastinum exists, that it really puts you in a dilemma in terms of adjuvant chemotherapy alone, or should you give radiation therapy with it? And that's a huge problem, I think, in the community.
I think you ask a more global question of where we should be doing and where, and I mentioned earlier the number of patients coming into the funnel. In other words, the total population. One of the reasons that they're lower, Mark and Harvey pointed out, poor surgery, poor staging. Okay, that's one reason. There are many other reasons. We're evolving in lung cancer. The total number of patients is relatively small that we have to answer various questions. But I think, don't be misled. We have some biologic information now that we can eventually, if we have enough patients to study, we have histology differentiation, we have molecular differentiation, all can have therapeutic implications. But we don't have enough patients coming into the funnel. There are several studies available right now, as Mark pointed out. We're involved with two adjuvant trials, and they're national trials. But
which two?
The Radiant and the vaccine trial, same as Ron. But it's going to be slow because the total number of patients is not there. I could tell you, and I bet you Vince would agree, there is reason now to have an adjuvant trial for mutated patients. And it wouldn't necessarily have to be that big because there'd probably be a huge difference, probably. But, you know, we don't have the number of patients to do all these trials. We're way behind breast and colorectal. By the way, the mesentery comes out with a colectomy. The surgeon doesn't have to. That's been done for years.
Yeah, except they weren't getting the nodes somehow.
Well, the pathologists weren't looking at
it. Pathologists, okay.
Yeah, and there are a lot of things here, but there's no question the total number of patients that are eligible for study is very small. It's going to change, and it'll change partly for why Harvey said, but it'll change because doctors eventually learn. It wasn't that long ago that a mediastinal node dissection or sampling didn't matter. The prognosis didn't change whether you did or didn't do it. I mean, there was no therapy that you could apply as a result of the difference between learning that. That's no longer true. Some of those surgeons still don't understand that because for years, it didn't matter whether they plucked out nodes out of the mediastinum. It didn't change the treatment for the patient. It didn't change the prognosis for
Tony,
the patient.
I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference at this point. But if you have a plumber that comes to your house and does your job, that plumber is usually licensed. And if that plumber did not do the job correctly, but he was licensed or certified, then he doesn't have to be paid. I think right now, and this is a novel concept, and this is a very difficult concept, but we have to hold standards, and there needs to be some way to do it. And it may be that there has to be, within the surgery community, with help from the payers, a blue ribbon, you know, consortium that says, these are the standards. This is why we need this. Here is some of the evidence base. We need to mandate this as part of quality care. And that may help with patients on trials as well as to have the right operation done.
Another practical question I'll ask you, Rogerio, is what about getting the patient involved? We actually, because when we saw 1505 come out, we're like, maybe you could use some help with accruals like 2 years ago. We finally got a grant, and we're actually doing a patient ed web-based program, audio, transcript. We interviewed the PIs of the study, interviewing patients, et cetera. You know, what was it like to get treated? You know, what did you think about going on the trial? Yet again, we think about the, quote, typical attitude of a patient in this situation. Do you think there's anything that could be gained by going to the patients about this, particularly ones that are in the community, to try to find trials?
Yes, and one of the issues we have with lung cancer is that we don't have strong advocacy groups the same way we have perhaps in breast cancer or prostate cancer. And these groups have been shown to be very effective in terms of educating patients with respect to clinical trials. The whole process is cumbersome. It's cumbersome for the doctors. It's cumbersome for the institutions. It's costly. It's difficult for the patient. I had the same exact issue that Mark just had. I had a patient who came to see me, had an appropriate lymph node dissection, eligible for the study, interested in the study. The patient's wife was a nurse, was very much in favor of the trial. And then they took the informed consent home. Has anybody here read the informed consent for 1505?
See, I actually think Ruggiero...
Has anybody read that? I am telling you, it is scary.
So that's one of the reasons that actually I found, in addition to the 12 months of therapy, I found the informed consent from 1505 is an absolute buzzkill.
It's brutal.
Okay? People read it and they're absolutely convinced that they're going to die from the therapy. Yeah. It's an incredibly severe informed consent.
Yeah. We're actually working with the National Lung Cancer Partnership on this project, and they actually have given us some great input. We're seeing that, though. You know, maybe it's not like breast cancer, but we're starting to see that in a lot. Myeloma has groups like this. But Tony, practically speaking, do you think this really could affect accrual, or do we really need to keep focusing on the docs?
Well, I think it can help, but we really need the patients to come down from the surgeons in this multidisciplinary approach, and they're not coming down. I'm in a major center for lung cancer, and we have multiple hospitals, and the total number of adjuvant candidates is relatively small. Whereas breast is huge, and the patients are there. We can just whittle them away for all the reasons we're talking about that are not eligible for the trials. It's not just poor surgery, but that is a major issue.
Let's go to the next topic. I want to move into a really exciting area, of course, in terms of EGFR. And we asked Tom to comment on several of the papers that were presented. I actually like, we have as a separate handout here, the IPES tumor marker study. And I actually like Tom, because to me, I personally, when I saw this stuff, I felt like, wow, this is really, in a way, almost the culmination of a lot of the work that you all have been doing the last few years. What a beautiful study this was. And Tom, if you can just go through it and also highlight, what do you think it means to docs in practice?
So I think that most of us in the field of EGFR mutations would argue pretty persuasively that IPASS was probably the most important study in our field that came out last year in lung cancer. And I think it really was a terrific example of how molecular profiling can actually impact outcome and impact the way we take care of patients. And what IPASS was, it was a study done principally in East Asia, the Pacific Rim. When we talk about Asian patients, we really want to make sure that people realize we're not talking about Indian, Pakistani, and Nepalese. We're talking really Pacific Rim patients. So it was done in China, Japan, Thailand, Taiwan, principally in adenocarcinoma patients who are light or never smokers. And if you look at the demographics of who was on the study, the majority were women who really were never smokers. And what they found was they randomized patients between gefitinib or carboplatin paclitaxel, first-line therapy, and found that progression-free survival was better for those patients who received gefitinib first-line, also found that there was a benefit in terms of symptom management and quality of life. The good news in this study really is the biomarker analysis that was done. There were 1,200 patients randomized, and they actually had 437 patients available for EGFR mutation analysis.
And I guess prior to that, they had presented the clinical results.
They presented the clinical results at ASCO. They gave more of the biomarker data that really helped to enrich this story. And what comes out in terms of the biomarkers is that the EGFR mutation positivity is a really important driver to helping decide which therapy is best. If you are mutation positive, that group has a clear benefit from receiving gefitinib. But what I've always said about IPASS, the most important part of IPASS is that if you are EGFR mutation negative, those are people who, despite being Asian female never smokers, should not be getting gefitinib first line. They did worse with gefitinib than they did with chemotherapy. So it becomes a compelling reason in my mind to not just use clinical criteria for driving care. And what they presented at ASCO was really just an update of how this panned out for other markers. And what they found was, again, confirming that EGFR mutation positivity was the strongest marker. FISH also looked like it was a positive predictive marker, but the FISH group and the EGFR mutation group in the IPAS study overlapped pretty substantially, and that probably explains why FISH also appeared to be an important predictor of outcome. So I think the IPAS study has been criticized for being just a study applicable to Asians. And I just want to put 2 cents in that I think that is a very wrong way of interpreting IPAS. I think IPAS is all about biology. I do not think it's about Asia. I think these will apply if this was done in a European population. It'll apply if it's done in any other population where you have a significant number of EGFR mutation positive patients. The reason it was done in Asia is because the incidence is so much higher there. But if you look at the outcome for how their EGFR mutants did with first-line gefitinib, it's very similar to data that we showed at MGH and data Vince has shown at Memorial and that people have shown around the country and in Europe when you treat people first-line with EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors.
So Vince, we've heard about IHC and FISH. Where is that heading, if anywhere?
Well, I think I would echo with Tom. I thought the IPAS biomarker data was illustrative and perhaps explaining the challenges in interpreting the FISH data because so many patients who have EGFR mutations may also have high gene copy number. But if you look at the patients who are mutation negative and at high EGFR copy number in IPAS, the hazard ratio was like 4 for gefitinib treatment. So clearly tracks with mutation as far as a benefit.
I mean, is there any reason, though, to look at FISH?
I personally think for predicting the efficacy of EGFR TKIs, no. It's conceivable the jury's out for cetuximab or maybe for some other agents, but I think for EGFR TKIs, the mutation is the critical question.
IHC?
I don't think there's any role for it.
Right. What's your clinical conclusion based on this, Tom, and how would you see this sort of actualize in clinical practice?
So I think if you have a patient who has an adenocarcinoma with a light smoking history, I think that patient should be tested for an EGFR mutation, and I think that that can be a very important part in driving upfront first-line therapy. And I think this has been reflected in the regulatory agencies in Europe now. Gefitinib is now approved in first-line therapy in Europe as well as in Asia for treating patients with EGFR mutation-positive disease.
So in that respect, can you present your patient? I think it's kind of relevant to what we're talking about.
Sure. So she's a 52-year-old. She's actually a research scientist. And years ago, she worked on EGFR, believe it or not. She presented with a left axillary mass, and her breast exam and mammogram were negative. She had a 15-pack year history of smoking, but she quit shortly after college, so it was way more than 20 years since she quit. She had a chest X-ray and chest CT. She had a 3-centimeter right upper lobe mass with hilar and mediastinal adenopathy, as well as the left axillary mass. A PET confirmed that disease. She had a brain MRI that showed 2 lesions that were consistent with metastatic disease. She had a biopsy.
Any neurologic symptomatology?
No. It was just done because I think, you know, we're all doing them because so far this lady might be BEV eligible.
What was her family constellation?
She came with her husband. Her husband's also a research scientist. He's a chair of a department at a local university and very supportive. I get emails from him quite a bit asking questions about this or that or have I seen this. He does my literature searches for me and sends me the appropriate things.
What was her state of mind?
Her state of mind was she was in a very proactive, I'm going to beat this disease kind of state at the time that I saw her. I was her second opinion.
Children?
No.
So what was the discussion like, or do you want to talk a little bit more about what happened
in terms of the workup? So she had a left axillary mass biopsy that showed a poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma, CK7 TTF1 positive, as well as I was given information that she was PDGF receptor positive.
Yeah, where did that come from? How did that get done?
I don't normally order that test, but she was being considered. There's a smaller institution in Durham. Many of you know it.
So that's where she went first?
Yeah. Hmm. So she went there, and they were running a trial that combined cis docetaxel in imatinib. And I guess one of the eligibility criteria is you had to be positive for the PDGF receptor. And she came to see me. I saw her in the morning. She had her CyberKnife appointment that afternoon to get her 2 lesions in her brain CyberKnifed, and she was slated to start on the trial the next day. And what would I do? And when I was preparing this case, I went back and read my original note because this was back in November, December.
And Mark, did you do anything to be sure she didn't have breast cancer? Did she get a breast MR? Did you ERPR?
ERPR was negative. She'd had a mammogram and a clinical exam that did not show any breast, and this was TTF1 positive, and she had a chest CT that looked
like she had lung cancer.
Okay. Yeah.
Anything new in terms of markers to help figure this thing out? I guess this case seems pretty straightforward.
I think this is pretty straightforward, but molecular profiling by RT-PCR or by even microarray is, I think, going to revolutionize the way we treat unknown cancer patients. And you use it in concert with immunoperoxidase and clinical features. This case, of course, is fairly straightforward. This is metastatic lung cancer.
Any new markers that you've been using that you think are encouraging?
Well, there are a number of markers that can be stained for that are proteins that come from the genes that are affected in this heterogeneous process. But the most interesting point that I think is, this is my view, I could change next month perhaps, molecular profiling is pointing towards the lineage of these cancers. In other words, a patient presents with an axillary mass, we might think in a woman that that could be a called breast cancer. However, if immunoperoxidase or immunostaining shows it to be a CK20 positive, CDX2 positive, those are colorectal stains. That suggests that it may be colorectal. And then you do a molecular profile and it's strongly intestinal. I think you have strong evidence there, yet to be totally validated, that you have a metastatic occult colorectal cancer. You following me? And it's true for others as well. Molecular profiling looks extremely interesting, but it's not totally validated in this patient
group. Just to follow up on what Tony's saying, I mean, there have been a couple of articles in ASCO about using this in the CUP, but the most interesting one, the newest, is the use of microRNAs, which with a profiling of microRNAs, you can actually find that certain microRNAs actually are associated with different types of tumors.
So you had to bring that up, so now I'm going to have to ask you, because I've been kind of curious what microRNA is.
These are small interfering RNAs that really are made in the nucleus and then cut and diced and cleaved and then actually associate with a suppressor complex, and they actually act like tumor suppressors and turn things off.
So they're short? Is that why they call them micro?
Yes, 22 nucleotides.
I think there are three major technologies right now. The classic microarray technique, the RT-PCR that looks at RNA, and the microRNAs.
MicroRNA.
Yes.
And actually, just to add to what Tony's saying, you know, I agree that microRNA and regular microarray profiling is going to help revolutionize this. And one thing we can actually, in the future, potentially even skip is the question of what the tumor of origin is if we've got good signatures for predicting drug response. In a way, it may not matter. So a lot of times we can develop markers, for example, let's say you respond to docetaxel and not pemetrexed or vice versa. And you may still refer to the tissue of origin, but what's more important is which is the drug that's working. So that's a complementary technology that's being developed. And I think eventually we'll still pay attention to the origin, but thinking more about the response phenotype.
Yeah, that could be true in known cancers too.
That's right.
I want to ask Ron how he might think through this case, and then we'll see actually what happened. But Tom, have you seen EGFR exon 19 or 21 mutation in a, quote, carcinoma of unknown primary? Is that lung cancer for sure, or could it be something else?
No, you can definitely have EGFR mutations in other sites of the body. There have been some gallbladder cancers with them described. There have some esophageal cancers. So you can definitely
respond to EGFR TKIs?
Anecdotally respond to EGFR TKIs.
But they're exquisitely rare.
Exquisitely rare.
We're talking like three log orders.
We're talking about the kind of things people come up to me at ASCO and tell me about from a meeting of that size.
Although they used to say that HER2 positivity was rare in gastric cancer, but in ASCO they reported 22% of these patients had HER2. What do you think about that, Tony, incidentally?
Very interesting. Again, another targeted, selected population that we have to individualize our approach to.
As long as we bring that up, anybody know anything about HER2 positivity in non-small cell?
That's been looked at. There's a minority of patients who have it, and the studies that have been done, Corey Langer and others, I think you may have been involved with those.
Less than 5%.
Less than 5%. Okay, so Ron, you have this lady, in spite of the terrible news that she has brain metastasis, still looking for proactive therapy. She's going to a place and been recommended to go in this trial of cis, docetaxel, imatinib. She's about to start CyberKnife, and she says, well, what do you think? Do you think I should be doing this? And if I weren't on this study, what would you be doing?
Yeah. Well, Mark, you mentioned that she had a fairly light smoking history, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah.
In remote.
Yeah. So, you know, for a young woman with metastatic adenocarcinoma of the lung, stage 4, who has a light smoking history, in the past, I would have strongly considered treating with erlotinib as part of her initial therapy, especially while she's getting radiation therapy to the brain, circumstances under which giving concurrent chemotherapy sometimes is a little problematic. But the results of the IPASS have really changed that for me. I agree with Tom's comments that the results of the biomarker studies from IPASS don't apply just to Asians, that this is biology. And one of the most striking aspects of the IPASS study, from my view, was the rate of progression of virtually non-smoking or light-smoking women with adenocarcinoma of the lung who were mutation negative, EGFR mutation negative, and received gefitinib as their first-line therapy.
It's comparable to placebo.
Yeah. Yeah. Over 50% of those patients had progression of their lung cancer by RECIST criteria, so more than 30% growth of their lung cancer within the first 6 weeks of starting treatment. That's a frightening rate of progression in a patient population that we would have normally considered having good demographics for treatment with an EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor. So I think in this patient, I would, first of all, have got an EGFR mutation test performed. And if positive, I think I would have started off treatment with an EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor.
And she says, geez, I'm really anxious about it. How long will it take to get back the test?
Well, that's always a dilemma. The turnaround time, at least in our institution, since we do it internally now, is about 5 days. If you have archival tissue available and she's had a biopsy, to ship this out and to get a turnaround in probably 7 to 10 days with Response Genetics or Genzyme or any of the commercial available testing.
So what were you thinking, Mark?
We discussed this as an option, and she was slated to start therapy then. And you know, as I said, she was very proactive. She was going to start treatment. And when you have to retrieve tissue from another institution, that adds 10 days.
Weeks.
Yeah. And so by the time we got it, sent it out and everything, it was literally 4 weeks. So she had had two cycles of treatment.
So you started her on what treatment?
Well,
she went on the trial.
Yeah, she went on the trial. She got cyst, docetaxel, and imatinib. And our arrangement was that she was going to see me after two cycles, because we would have the mutation result then, and we would have some idea of how she was responding. And so we got the testing back in 4 weeks.
And incidentally, what fraction of patients with non-small are PDGFR positive? Anybody know?
I don't know the answer to that question.
It's a couple of percent. Yeah. I mean,
a couple of percent.
Yeah, it's another
so she was very unusual.
1 to 2%.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what do we know about imatinib in those patients?
We think it may be more than a bystander. We think it may be more relevant to maintaining the tumor, and that's the rationale, I think, for the study. We're going to add it to our snapshot.
So she got two cycles of chemo imatinib. How did she do in terms of side effects and toxicity?
She had a tough time with the cyst docetaxel.
With what specifically?
Nausea, vomiting, and fatigue.
How about the imatinib?
Didn't seem to buy it. I couldn't. I mean,
couldn't separate that out.
I think it's the first time I've ever used imatinib, actually. Or been involved with a patient who was on imatinib.
And then you got back to mutation testing?
Got back to mutation testing. She'd had two cycles, and I think by the time I got in touch with her, she had had her scan, her first scan after two cycles, and she had had a dramatic response.
To chemo?
Yeah.
Terrific. When in doubt, there's nothing wrong with chemo. And if you think back to what Ron just said, the chemo arm doesn't do that badly, you know, who's mutation positive. And if she has a response, I would push that response, even if I found out she had a mutation. Right. If she's responding, keep pushing that response as long as you can, and then switch to Tarceva when you are finished with whatever that regimen is.
Well, exactly. And so we found out from Genzyme that she had an exon 19 mutation, and she was KRAS negative. And I said, this is good. It creates another option for you. She goes, but I'm responding to treatment. So I said, well, get four cycles. She got six. She really felt worn out after six. And then the question came up what to do at that point.
So interesting point here, and Tom raised this before about IPASS. If you look at the EGFR mutation positive patients in IPASS, their response rate to chemotherapy was actually double. It was 47 versus 23%.
What do you think is going on biologically? Do they have a higher proliferation fraction?
It's a great question. We actually have a research effort centered around this and radiation response. They're also very radiation sensitive. And we think it's related to the fact that EGFR actually does modulate DNA repair and things that modulate radiation sensitivity and chemotherapy sensitivity, and may have to do with whether EGFR gets into the nucleus or not. So that's an active area of research. But to go back to this point, and I would be interested in Vince's perspective on this, because I know Memorial Sloan Kettering, very frequently patients will get chemotherapy with erlotinib. This would be the type of patient where I'd love to make sure they get a full chemotherapy response and then at a minimum maintenance erlotinib. If you think about the ATLAS and Saturn data,
right,
patients with EGFR mutations, there was a hazard ratio of
0.1.
So there, I guess I'd argue the best possible therapy would be make sure they get chemotherapy given the response rate and an EGFR inhibitor.
So based on what you're saying, John, would you, even in possession of that information, a patient is EGFR mutation positive, would you still give that patient chemo in addition to the EGFR TKI?
We're trying to figure out what the best chemo to give with that is. Yeah, so right now we're just starting with erlotinib, but I would prefer, and I suspect, for example, pemetrexed cisplatin or docetaxel cisplatin, either intercalated or giving the erlotinib as maintenance.
Also, if you look at the PFS curves for the mutants, they kind of run together until you get done your chemo. And when the chemo stops, the curve starts to drop, whereas the gefitinib curve continues.
The thing would push me toward thinking that single-agent TKI is going to do better, or TKI-based therapy, I'm not saying single-agent, is that you do have these patients, these outliers, who are the 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 year patients. And Vince has a couple, I have a couple, Mark, Chris has a couple. And those are people who've never seen chemo.
Right.
We have a lot more to talk about. Vince, you were going to talk about the CALGB study. And also just a brief bottom line on, I think, Tom, you were going to comment on this, but maybe we can ask Vince too, on the Saturn and Atlas data.
So CALGB 30406 is a randomized phase 2 trial, 180 patients, adenocarcinoma, 10-pack year or less smoking history, mandatory tissue, not from an FNA, either from a resection or a core biopsy, which randomizes patients to erlotinib or erlotinib with carboplatin. So based on the never smokers, that latter group in the TRIBUTE trial, where they had a very good 22-month median survival. Trials completed accrual. Passiani is the PI and the co-PI. Any tissues being, I guess it gets shipped from the OSU repository up to Dana-Farber, where he will do hierarchical testing on these, but certainly starting with EGFR mutation. We predict that based on the demographics, probably 30 to 40% of patients in each 90-patient arm would have an EGFR mutation. So you'd have 35 patients treated with erlotinib alone, mutation positive, mutation negative. I think Tom and I and others probably feel pretty strongly how that group will fare. And if you have a hazard ratio of 0.1, you know, you may see a statistically meaningful difference. And the other arm, of course, will be a chemo question. You know, chemo with erlotinib versus chemo without or chemo with erlotinib in mutated or non-mutated patients. We're hoping to have it for ASCO next year, both clinical and molecular presentations, perhaps.
So, Tom, what do you think is going to be seen?
I actually don't know what it's going to show.
I mean, it's become an incredibly relevant trial.
It's a much more relevant question
than it was when it was originally designed.
They all get erlotinib and half get chemo. And my bias is that it'll be tough to beat erlotinib alone, but you never know.
So maybe you can talk a little bit about Atlas and Saturn. To be honest with you, as we've been sifting through what happened in ASCO and, you know, tons of tumors, as I thought about it, I was just kind of curious, in addition to maybe you're talking about what was presented, what you think the meaning of this is clinically in view of what happened with IPASS. Is it even relevant anymore? Maybe you can talk about the data that was presented.
So I think the Atlas trial, which is a question of whether erlotinib adds to bevacizumab maintenance in patients who didn't progress and who got bevacizumab with chemo, and Saturn, which is a question of erlotinib maintenance in two populations, an IHC-positive population or an unselected population, I really think address a different set of issues than what we're talking about with IPASS and CALGB 30406. By and large, these are unselected trials. They're not genotypically enriched by any biomarker that I think is, you know, horribly relevant. And I think that they bring up a different question of maintenance, which is also relevant to pemetrexed based on the data that Milani and others presented from the JMEN study.
Now, you mentioned the JMEN study, which is the phase 3 trial presented at ASCO 2008, showing a PFS benefit for maintenance pemetrexed following platinum-based chemo for non-squamous tumors. And I do want to get into that study. But first, can you talk a little bit about the Atlas and Saturn trials looking at maintenance erlotinib and what was seen there in terms of benefit?
So in both Atlas and Saturn, the hazard ratio in favor of the TKI was approximately 0.7. One was 0.72, one was 0.71. The difference at the median in the Saturn trial was 1 week, but the overall curve was, and that sort of correlated to a point where patients were being evaluated for response or progression. So that the curves came together rather closely at the point of the median PFS, but were fairly robust otherwise. In Atlas, the difference was maintained fairly well over the entire sort of lifespan of the patients, and the difference at the median PFS was 3.75 and 4.75 months, so a month difference in median PFS there.
So, Tom, what do you think this means practically at this point?
So I think Saturn, probably even more so than Atlas, is a study that's going to impact patient care, because this whole movement, and I don't think you can look at Saturn and Atlas in isolation. I think you have to look at them in relationship to the maintenance pemetrexed study and even the maintenance docetaxel study that Phidias published. So I actually think that all four of these studies are really bringing up an incredibly important question in lung cancer, which is the importance of maintenance / early second line. I think we've adopted the word maintenance to explain this group of patients where you treat after four cycles of chemotherapy, you switch to a second agent and begin that agent and give it as monotherapy in that setting. And I think that these studies, all four of them, consistently show that PFS is prolonged. And in the pemetrexed study, we saw that overall survival was prolonged. The problem for the doc is how this data all gets put together and how it gets interpreted. And one of the concerns I have, I'm very curious what the group thinks, has been that, and I thought that Nestor Hanna's discussion was fantastic, but I think it does reflect a bias of the thought leaders. And the bias is that as long as you get second-line therapy, you're doing fine. And we know this from all these trials. The people who actually got pemetrexed in the delayed arm or got Tarceva in the delayed arm did just as well as the people who got it right after chemo. And so the way that's been interpreted, it's been interpreted to mean that as long as I give them second-line therapy, they're going to do just as well. And the thought leaders feel, I'm a good enough doc that I can tell who's going to relapse, and therefore I can wait. I'm going to put the pause in there. And my only argument is, that I was one of those docs on that study who treated those patients, and we weren't good enough to tell. And there was a survival difference in the pemetrexed arm. So I think we have to take this data much more seriously than what many of my colleagues have felt. And I think it is practice changing in terms of how I approach people with lung cancer now.
We're going to talk about pemetrexed, but what I want to focus more on is the TKIs, because it kind of reflects your patient, Mark. That state of the art now is when you have a patient who's a non-smoker or minimal smoker, you get an EGFR mutation and start them on a TKI. If you run into a situation, as Mark did, in a sense where it was a delay or it's a second opinion or whatever, you still get them on a TKI as soon as possible.
And
it's not like really
you.
A maintenance
right.
thing.
But that only applies to such a small percentage of patients. I think this data has an application to every single patient with lung cancer.
Well, I mean, my interpretation is if patients should have EGFR testing, and if they're positive, they need to go on a TKI. You know,
either immediately or after four cycles of chemo.
Or if they're on the chemo. I mean, that's different than what you're talking about with pemetrexed to me.
Yeah, you know,
am I not seeing this
right? The study, and Vince mentioned, this ATLAS trial is unselected patients molecularly, yet it carries the day. And again, I've used this analogy before. Years ago, if you used tamoxifen across the board in breast cancer without respect to estrogen receptor, you would see tamoxifen versus a placebo. You would see an advantage. The reason you saw it was because of the mixture of the enriched patients. For doctors to use erlotinib as maintenance treatment in all their patients is ridiculous. Because of the IPASS and other data we have from around the country now, you wouldn't want to use that. It's too expensive, and most of those patients don't benefit from it. Yet the study didn't take that into account. So it's, in my opinion, foolish to use erlotinib as a maintenance just because it showed in ATLAS there, unless the patient has the target.
Agree or disagree?
Well, you're preaching to the converted. I guess the issue is when you talk to the biostatisticians, they'll tell you that the whole curve is not driven by the mutant patients and that sort of thing on these studies. I'm not sufficiently savvy in doing these analyses to say whether that's true or not. I certainly agree with Tony that the type patient in whom I'd consider this strategy is someone with the genotype. But again, the data for ATLAS is unselected patients. We also, just to be all courant, should know that there was a press release that the Saturn trial, which had that minuscule difference in median PFS, did meet a survival endpoint, although the hard data were not presented in the press release, and it's going to be presented at IASLC. And I agree with Tom that I think particularly in Europe, where their treatment options are narrower, will have a substantial impact on practice.
I want to actually have you present your case in a second, because I want to get into some of the more sophisticated issues here. But just to go back to Ron, what about gefitinib? Are we ever going to have that available in the United States? Should we have it available? I always thought how the whole thing rolled out at the time that happened was kind of weird. I hadn't seen something like that before. What do you think?
I think that's going to be an FDA issue as to whether or not they want to revisit any of this data. I do think that the more and more that we focus on the targeted population that should receive an EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor, the more one can justify the use of gefitinib. Because I think the real differences between gefitinib and erlotinib are in the wild type patient population, that erlotinib is a more potent drug or perhaps used at a higher dose and has a marginally greater effect on patients with wild-type EGFR. But in my opinion, the IPASS data and the Saturn data, although we need to see what this survival outcome looks like, it's clear that it's the mutated patients that are carrying the lion's share of the benefit. In the Saturn data that was presented at ASCO, the progression-free survival hazard ratio for the EGFR mutated subpopulation was 0.10. Wasn't the 0.7 for the overall population.
90% reduction.
Yeah, so if you subtract that patient population out, you barely have a progression-free survival advantage for the EGFR wild type. It'll be interesting to see how that translates to the survival outcome. My prediction is that the survival outcome is probably going to be carried predominantly by that EGFR mutation subset. There may still be some marginal benefit to the non-mutated subset, but I think it's going to be small and allows us to legitimately raise the question that I agree with you, Tom, that Nasser Hanna summarized beautifully from a patient's perspective. Doctor, will I live longer? Will I live better? And if the margin of benefit, if the hazard ratio is 0.9 or 0.88, that's marginal benefit, in my opinion, and the toxicities are not trivial.
So, John, is this kind of like an anastrozole versus letrozole thing, except we didn't have ER when they were first tested? Is there even a theoretical advantage of gefitinib, or are they basically the same drug?
I think your analogy is a very good one, so I can tell you that structurally they're very similar. And from testing them head-to-head in the laboratory in different settings, there aren't any meaningful differences between them. In the laboratory, for example, they both are similarly ineffective against EGFR with T790M mutations. That would be an important difference.
Or any exon 20 mutation.
Yeah, well, and you know they're similarly effective against those with EGFR mutations. And when we compare them to the models, they perform similarly. So I suspect it was just a dose and potency issue and not a real structural difference between them or the patient populations they were tested in.
Any toxicology differences clinically?
Again, clinically, I think you can explain all the observations in all likelihood by the dose for the most part. Now, there are some subtle differences that have been seen anecdotally with activity against an L858R versus an exon 19 deletion. But if you look at the bulk of the data, and Tom is reviewed this very nicely in some large studies, you know, they both have response rates in the 70 to 80% range as monotherapy for patients with EGFR mutations. You know, with the recent interest study saying that docetaxel and gefitinib are comparable, we don't have that exact same data for erlotinib. One can argue, well, we've got an approved drug, we've got a less toxic drug that is similarly effective. Doesn't that argue for that gefitinib should be approved as well? But you know, comparatively, it's hard to see what advantage gefitinib would have over erlotinib. I can't conceive that there is an important one.
So, Vince, can you present your case?
Sure. So this is a young woman born in France, 45, of Chinese ethnicity, parents being born in the Pacific Rim, who presented with pulmonary symptoms in December and was found to have multiple pulmonary nodules and a large pleural effusion. And a thoracentesis was done that confirmed adenocarcinoma, TTF1 positive, CK7 positive, CK20 negative, ERPR, calretinin negative. And she was referred to see me for treatment. And when we see patients, and I think this will resonate with the practitioners who listen to this, we said, can you please bring 15 unstained slides? Well, of course, there's three scenarios. About a third of them bring the 15 unstained slides. One third bring two slides, one of which is stained. And the other group brings 15 stained slides. So she was one of the categories that didn't help me to genotype her. And, you know, we feel strongly about genotyping these people based on IPASS, as Ron and others have alluded to. So we put the wheels in motion. We tried to run some interference, you know, get a new scan, get your brain scan, et cetera, run a little interference till we could get the slides and then prioritize them in our testing queue. But her symptoms, despite the fact that she had one thoracentesis, really became intractable, and we felt compelled to start treatment prior to getting her genotyped.
And how symptomatic was she, and where were
the
symptoms?
Well, her effusion was on the left. She couldn't lie on her left side at night, as you might expect, and she was dyspneic because she worked in a restaurant that the family owns and was having trouble doing that. She was clearly symptomatic.
But it was from the pleural effusion.
Yeah.
And was it reaccumulating rapidly?
Yeah, it reaccumulated rapidly. We could have tapped her again. I was trying to avoid doing a Pleurex at that point because I thought if I got her on the right treatment, it might just disappear.
So what would you be thinking, Tony?
Well, first, this clinical presentation is a little unusual for lung cancer with multiple pulmonary nodules, no dominant mass, I guess. But the immunohistochemical profile is certainly consistent with it. This is another area where I think molecular profiling would nail it down. You know, again, I think this is probably lung cancer. How would I initially treat this patient with the data I have presented by Vince?
Knowing that you're not going to have mutation status maybe for a few weeks or who knows?
Yeah, I would probably treat this patient with a pemetrexed-based regimen, chemotherapy alone in this setting.
And you wouldn't use Bev?
I probably would add it, but the basis of what I would be using here would be the chemotherapy with pemetrexed and platinum.
What would you be thinking, Tom, and what about erlotinib?
So I wouldn't use, I mean, she hasn't been tested, so I wouldn't use erlotinib. I'd use chemotherapy, either carboplatin Taxol Bev or carboplatin pemetrexed.
And knowing her symptomatology and site of disease, if she did prove to have a mutation, would
Oh, if she had a mutation, I would start her on erlotinib right away.
Erlotinib or erlotinib chemo?
I would start her on erlotinib right away.
Would you add bevacizumab to the erlotinib in this case, given the pleural effusion?
I wouldn't. I think your point about the pleural effusion is interesting because there are some people who feel that Bev particularly works against effusions and ascites and can have activity in that setting. And I actually believe that if you want to find some nugget of positivity from beta, it's in the group of never smokers in the beta trial. Granted, it's a different setting, second line setting, but a group of patients who seem to benefit from the combination. I don't think I'd fault somebody who added Bev to erlotinib in this setting, but I would try very hard to get her on erlotinib. We actually had a trial that was shot down by the IRB and by the NCI that had Bev and erlotinib in mutants. They would not let us make the leap of faith because they felt it was pretty well established that Bev did not add anything in that setting.
Neil, one of the things that's overlooked because of how the data was presented in the IPASS study is that if you look at the progression-free survival for patients who received carboplatin Taxol as their first-line treatment, there was no difference in the progression-free survival in the EGFR mutation and EGFR non-mutated group, even though the EGFR mutation group had a much higher objective response rate. Now, those patients who received chemotherapy first, the majority of them went on to receive gefitinib second-line treatment. Some received a third line. That's where there was a real difference in the survival outcome. The EGFR mutated group had a survival outcome that gets out to around 20 months. And the EGFR non-mutated group, despite receiving gefitinib at the same frequency, had a median survival that's down closer to around 13 months or so.
So Vince, can you follow up with what happened?
Sure. Well, many of these issues ran through my mind in treating her. And I actually chose to treat her as a never smoker. I actually gave her carboplatin or cisplatin, pemetrexed, Bev, and erlotinib. And she began on that, got two cycles of therapy, and had a very good response. And by this time, we had her genotyping data back. And the way we do things in our LC-MAP project is we do EGFR and KRAS first. And then if they're negative, we look at some other tests.
So what did you see or what happened with the assay?
So this is the necessity to do molecular diagnostics. She was EGFR and KRAS non-mutated. And so she went on to have testing for a relatively new fusion protein that's been identified that's oncogenic, the EML4-ALK, and was positive for that.
So what's her current situation?
Her current situation is she doesn't know this good news yet, but I'm very excited.
I think it's good news. I would have rather have a mutation, wouldn't you?
So, well, the EML4-ALK, this is a mutant kinase, which is eminently druggable, which has a nice high response rate. And so I have the next move planned for this lady. I'm trying to figure out, as we talked about another patient, exactly how long I should continue her treatment and which components of it. Certainly the erlotinib we're going to stop, and we'll look at 4 to 6 cycles of cytotoxic therapy.
How's she doing on the treatment?
She's doing well.
Any Bev problems?
Back to
any
work.
Erlotinib problems?
No Bev problems. Some rash. Didn't necessitate any treatment interruption or dose reduction. And she's happy.
You know that IPASS study that Tom mentioned, 40% of the patients who were basically non-smokers did not have an EGFR mutation.
Right. So the maximum clinical enrichment we can do is 60%.
So this is the way next year, hopefully, we'd meet. Everybody's going to be approaching patients this way. But Tom, we wanted you to talk about the paper at ASCO looking at EML4-ALK. And also maybe comment on the paper looking at re-biopsy, which you had mentioned before.
So two important things. That first, let's talk about the EML4-ALK because that's more related to Vince's case first. But the paper that was presented by Alice Shaw from our group at Mass General looked at testing for EML4-ALK. EML4-ALK was described initially in Japan. And then what our group did was we looked at about 150 patients who were never smokers. And what Alice Shaw reported at ASCO were some clinical characteristics of these patients. So the patients, the absolute percentage of EML4-ALK translocations was about half as common as EGFR mutations. So if EGFR mutations are 11%, EML4-ALK is about 5% of all comers with lung cancer. That might be a little bit on the upper end. It might be closer to 3.5 to 4, but we found about 5%. And just like EGFR mutations, you can enrich in the never smoking population. They tend to be more often men, okay? They tend to be younger, so 10 years younger on average than the EGFR mutants at the Mass General and Harvard. So we found these translocations in this group of patients to be similar in having the same non-smoking phenotype. They didn't respond to tyrosine kinase inhibitors for EGFR. So they didn't respond to erlotinib, which is one of the reasons we haven't been treating these people with erlotinib. Their response to chemo was pretty similar to what the EGFR mutant's response to chemo has been, understanding it's a small series and this may not pan out with larger series. But the most exciting thing about the EML4-ALK was actually, in addition to Alice's paper, was Eunice Kwok's phase 1 trial that she reported at ASCO, which is a phase 1 trial of the Pfizer compound, the Pfizer MET inhibitor. Turns out the Pfizer MET inhibitor has crossover with ALK, the anaplastic lymphoma kinase, and it shuts off the anaplastic lymphoma kinase. And what Eunice reported is basically this is oncogene addiction. This is just like EGFR mutation. These patients have about 70% of patients responded. I had two or three of my own patients in this trial who had EML4-ALK who had smashing, beautiful responses, CRs in their lung, brought back from the edge of death, essentially, with this compound against EML4-ALK. So I think when your comment was it would be better to find out if you EGFR mutation, maybe.
Maybe not. Huh?
Maybe not. I mean, I think this is actually a very, very similar analogous situation to EGFR mutants. I also believe that this is something that the practicing doc needs to be aware of, because if they test and they find a never smoker doesn't have an EGFR mutation, they should be screening for EML4-ALK translocations.
How do they do that? Where do they send it?
So if you look at EGFR, KRAS, wild type, never smokers, now some of this is semantics, but about 25% of them will have EML4-ALK. The diagnostics are not standardized yet because the two genes are very close together on chromosome 2. So that's the issue. So some of the interpretations are hard.
So you can do both FISH and IHC. FISH is a much more sensitive test. The problem with IHC, it's not as specific. So an EML4-ALK that's positive by FISH will be positive for ALK by IHC. The problem is a lot of cancers that don't have this will be positive for ALK by IHC. So IHC is not a perfect test. The better test is to do the FISH assay for it at this point.
ALK is activated lymphoma kinase, so these are tyrosine kinases. And just as in random recombination events, these two genes become linked together and make a fusion protein analogous to BCR-ABL and CML.
And what type of cancer you have depends upon what the partner gene is with ALK. So you can have gastric cancer that has an ALK translocation with a different partner. You can have a lymphoma, okay? The people have anaplastic lymphoma. But these anaplastic lymphoma, the ALK-positive tumors, have a different translocation. And so it depends upon what the translocation with ALK is in terms of what type of cancer you get.
ALK is a cytoplasmic tyrosine kinase. It's not one of these receptor tyrosine kinases.
Cytoplasmic tyrosine kinase.
So there's a whole family, as Tom and Vince mentioned before. And so, you know, there's a lot of tyrosine kinases that don't have a transmembrane domain. They're not activated normally by extracellular signals the way EGFR is. They're activated from intracellular signaling events. So if you look at SARC is one that we think of that we target all the time, and FIN and LIC, and there's a whole family of them. And the analogy to BCR-ABL is a good one because ABL is one of the normal kinases that's signaling inside the cell. It's exclusively inside the cell. It's not transmembrane. But when you get the fusion with BCR-ABL, now you've got a larger fusion that stays active all the time. And that's analogous here. You're fusing it with a different partner, but now you're turning something that's normally not active, or it's activated in only a regulated way, and you're fusing it so it becomes always activated, always turned on.
In terms of the MET inhibitor, same thing as the TKI with EGFR, it's a competitive blocking that goes on there, or what happens that it turns it off, Vince?
Well, I don't know if it was serendipity or not that this also got ALK. I don't know. We knew the drug up front.
It was screened up front. We knew that it would get ALK up front. And so going into the trial, it was a phase one trial, supposedly for patients who were MET amplified. And so we were screening tons of cancers for MET amplification. And that comes to the second paper. But we were screening for MET amplification. But we knew that also the ALK was a target. So we had that information up front. That was preclinically predicted that ALK would be a target. What wasn't understood is that this was the oncogene addiction story again, and that shutting down ALK would turn off the malignant switch.
Vince?
We'd like to EGFR test all adenocarcinomas because there is a frequency, you know, even of people at 30, 40, 50, 60 pack years. But their genetics are much more complicated, and the duration of response, even when they have an activating mutation of the TKI, is shorter, speaking to what Tom said. I think the number that we sort of throw around based on studies that we and Matt Meyerson and other people have done is that maybe about half the patients will have some sort of driver kinase mutation that
you find. That's lung cancer specifically?
Yeah, I think for a lung cancer, maybe you have a driver kinase mutation that you can really latch onto therapeutically. And the rest we're going to need to sort out with a variety of other studies, chromosomal gains and losses and things like that. And our next step is really to identify the things that modify the behavior of different tumors that have the same EGFR mutation, to come up with combination strategies.
So I want to kind of conclude this segment on, you know, some of the molecular issues and EGFR. Go back to John. What else do docs need to know in terms of what might be coming in terms of all these markers?
Sure. So to talk about T790M first, and this was initially described at Dana-Farber and Memorial and MGH groups as well. So this is a mutation. Normally, erlotinib is an ATP mimetic. So ATP normally binds to these receptors, and it's the third phosphate on ATP that gets removed and put on other proteins. That's part of how signaling works. So ATP binds into this pocket where it fits neatly. Erlotinib and gefitinib and other tyrosine kinase inhibitors mimic the shape of ATP. They've got a very similar structure, except they don't have the same phosphates that get donated. So they fit in the pocket and they block the receptor that way. Starting with the CML experience with imatinib, it was noted there was a mutation there where it prevented imatinib from binding into the pocket of the BCR-ABL oncogene and caused resistance to imatinib. And similar mutations have been noted now in other diseases. It turns out that the T790 amino acid residue is exactly in that same location. So it sticks out into this ATP binding pocket. And if it's mutated to methionine, hence the T790M, meaning threonine at 790 to methionine, it prevents erlotinib or gefitinib from fitting into this pocket. Now, if you think of this pocket sort of as a cave, there are some other inhibitors that instead of going into the cave, actually can sort of sit at the mouth of the cave and covalently bind and prevent other things from inhibiting. And one group of those are irreversible EGFR inhibitors. One of the earliest ones tested was kinertinib or CI-1033, EKB-569 was another one in development. One of the ones that's advanced in development now that's being tested is BIBW-2992 as an irreversible inhibitor. And that one has certainly shown evidence of early activity, and there are people here that are involved.
That's also a TKI?
That's right. It's an irreversible TKI, and it hits both EGF receptor and other EGF receptor family members.
And how does it look chemically compared to gefitinib or
erlotinib? Well, it's got a multi-ring structure like ATP does and like these other structures do, but it has some other rearrangements so it doesn't fit into the pocket in exactly the same way. So it's also a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, but just a different profile of activity. Now, the study we were talking about from William Pao's group and the Memorial Sloan Kettering group that Vince would be very familiar with study as well was after the rebiopsy of patients with EGFR TKI resistance, they observed one patient who had another mutation where the residue also protruded into the pocket and also prevented erlotinib or gefitinib from getting in there. And like the T790M mutation, this mutation was also inhibited by BIBW2992. So I think this illustrates now that if we're thinking about EGFR TKI resistance, now we have a handful of things to consider. We've got the T790M mutation is the most common one, as Tom and Vincent mentioned before, but we've got another mutation to think about, now the second one at the 584 position. We've got MET amplification to think about as a possibility. RAS mutation is another one. So there's a growing list of mechanisms that we can think about for patients who progress after an EGFR inhibitor, and ultimately we're going to have to tailor our therapies to fit that. And we have a paper that came out in Clinical Cancer Research last month, and one of the things we observed is in preclinical models, VEGF can get upregulated as part of EGFR TKI resistance, and blocking that can actually overcome the resistance as well, and we're investigating how that happens. So there's a host of different changes that can lead to you being resistant to an EGFR TKI inhibitor.
So actually, Vince, you were going to talk about BIBW2992, and there are several papers here. Maybe we can ask you to comment on that. But before we do, Tom, what about the issue of, quote, irreversible binding? How much of an advantage theoretically do you think that would be?
I think theoretically it might be an advantage. I am not yet convinced that it has been shown yet to make a huge difference in terms of how patients do. So I would say right now that's still in the realm of the theoretical in terms of actually proving that you can change outcome.
So Vince, what exactly is BIBW2992 and what do we know about it clinically?
So let me just amplify something that John said and that Tom's very familiar with because it came from investigators at his institution, is that there's sort of two prevailing mechanisms as to how T790M functions. One is the steric hindrance or clash. The bigger amino acid blocks the erlotinib accessing the ATP binding pocket. The second mechanism of action that's discussed is whether the T790M actually changes the relative affinity of that ATP binding site and shifts it in favor of ATP rather than the drug, and so that you need drug basically at higher concentration, say, be it even erlotinib, for example, might work clinically. That looks like when you do the numbers with the PK with erlotinib, even given once weekly at high doses, you can't attain that. But I can't tell you how many times in the last 6 months I've been asked for PK data, which we never did in our phase one trial of once weekly high dose erlotinib by people from biotech. It's amazing. So there's a lot of mathematical modeling of overcoming T790M resistance presented at AACR this year.
But in vitro, it has to be at least two orders of magnitude difference. I mean, in terms of the sensitivity, it's huge because we go over 10 micromolar in vitro and it's still resistant.
Yeah, so you can't achieve it with erlotinib, but you probably could. I mean, BIBW, the number's very close, but if you looked like a high-dose once weekly schedule of BIBW, it might actually work.
How exactly does the BIBW molecule work? What is it?
So it's a multi-ring structure with covalent bonds at two critical residues in EGFR, one in EGFR and one in HER2. So it's a dual EGFR-HER2 inhibitor.
What about VEGF? No VEGF?
No, it's pure for EGFR and HER2 in all the kinase screens I've seen.
How is it administered? What kind of toxicology?
It's given orally. It has class effects, diarrhea, rash. And there are two trials that are in your packet. One is a phase two trial in patients prospectively screened for EGFR mutations, done largely in Asia. It's a hybrid of first-line and second-line patients.
What did they see there?
So a good activity, really too early to say in looking at different cross studies whether it compares favorably with, say, drugs like erlotinib or not, and whether we'll see T790M, you know, universally emerge or commonly emerge as a mechanism of resistance, or whether we'll shunt to sort of a different mechanism of acquired resistance when patients fail this drug.
There was a paper at ASCO, and some of those patients had failed chemo or erlotinib or gefitinib.
That's a LUX-1 trial, a randomized phase 3 trial, 2-to-1 of BIBW2992 versus placebo with no crossover. Crossover was suggested but not allowed by the regulatory authorities. The trial is close to accrual. And it's a survival trial, and it's being done just based on the frequency of these mutations, largely in Asia, the bulk of the accrual will come from.
Have any of these patients had TKIs before?
Yeah, so these are TKI failures.
TKI failures.
Now, the mechanism of TKI failure will not be universally known in this population because the patients will not have been uniformly rebiopsied.
Do these people have responses and then failure, or they could have just failed right
straight? Well, that's a great point. And actually, Dave Jackman spent some time in this, and Tom and I have been working on a couple of things to try to provide guidelines for this. But there are different ways you can design these trials. One can be with clinical criteria, and the other could be molecular. But this is a clinically driven trial that the individuals must have been on a TKI for 12 weeks or more and have non-progressive disease. But that could be somebody with indolent lung cancer whose tumor grew 15%. Or it could be somebody whose cancer disappeared for 2 years.
Where do you think this agent is heading, Tom?
So I think if you had a drug that could work for patients who progressed on erlotinib or gefitinib, I think that's one niche for this drug. I think the question for this drug in first line, and this is not the only one like this, the question for these drugs is, I think, is, in first line, do they provide an advantage in terms of prolonging the time before you have to switch therapy? Does it improve your progression-free survival? And ultimately, do you live longer and live better? So if you, instead of having a PFS of 11 months or 12 months, which is what we see with erlotinib, if the PFS is 18 months, that's a fantastic advantage. And it may be that by targeting T790M earlier in the course of therapy, and possibly if there's some benefit against HER2, we don't know that. But if targeting earlier in therapy prevents emergence of resistance, one would expect PFS to be longer.
You're saying T790M, so this agent targets that also?
This agent also has activity against T790M. Hmm. And so the thought would be, just like with a number of types of resistance, if you can treat before resistance emerges, you may prolong that time before you become resistant. And so I think that's one of the things I'd like to see from these trials and that people are hoping that we see.
Using the analogy with HIV drugs, for example, where you're combining not only the primary treatment, but things meant to avoid the emergence of resistance. I mean, what do you think about combinations of erlotinib, which has potentially more potent against the conventionally mutated receptor, with BIBW-2922 and other reversible inhibitors?
I'd say two things. One is BIBW or the others should be as good as erlotinib against the native mutation. But I think your point, John, is very well taken. I mean, I think that we should be thinking, one of my frustrations, Neil, is I think ultimately if you have a mutation positive non-small cell lung cancer, EGFR mutation positive, you're looking at 4-drug therapy. Okay, we would never, Tony Greco would never have treated lymphoma with 2 years of Cytoxan, followed by 2 years of Incristine, followed by 2 years of prednisone, and 2 years of Adriamycin.
So what are the 4 drugs?
So the 4 drugs would be something that targets the native mutation, something that targets T790M, something that targets c-MET, perhaps a drug that's anti-angiogenic, perhaps a drug that targets autophagy or metabolism.
Vince, what about cetuximab?
Cetuximab is an interesting drug because, A, we're not sure how it works, or if you're a cynic, you're not sure if it works, but I do believe it has some meaningful activity. And it has effect on the, I guess you'd call it the metabolome of the cell that we're sort of interested in. It has
metabolome?
You know, it has effect on the serum glucose transporter.
Ah.
And that may be that by changing sort of the intracellular biochemistry, things they sort of go beyond me, maybe John or somebody else understands them, but, you know, the pH well and glycolysis and things like that, you can more favorably affect how the EGFR TKIs work, that one mechanism of escape that's not well characterized. Remember, we don't know why these drugs fail in 30 to 40% of cases, maybe almost a microenvironment one based on things like pH, type glycolysis used in the cell and that sort of thing. So we have a trial that's actually ongoing with cetuximab and erlotinib in patients who failed erlotinib. And unequivocally, there are some biologic effects of the combination with some reductions in tumor, both in patients with and without T790M. Right now, they don't seem too durable. So it's tantalizing that if one used maybe a better EGFR TKI or could capitalize more on how the cetuximab is actually working.
Yeah. Another question I want to ask the group is, why don't all patients who have EGFR mutated tumors respond to EGFR TKIs?
So you've got your consistent 30% who don't. Some of them may have T790M at diagnosis. There's some who do, who have T790M at diagnosis. Some will have MET amplification at diagnosis. But I think there's a bigger group of these patients that we don't know the reason
why. So neither T790 nor the c-MET are necessarily acquired at a later stage or after exposure to an EGFR TKI, correct?
I think they're selected for.
I'd point out, too, that, you know, trastuzumab only has about a 50% response rate in HER2-positive breast cancer.
Absolutely.
In terms of TKIs and lung cancer mutations, you're actually above that.
Yeah. And, you know, John, but it's not the same for imatinib.
Yeah, Gleevec does
better. CNO, for example.
That's
so
true.
That, you know, so that there's something
you wonder
a little different about
that.
Move
beyond, you know, if it's acquired additional mutations that make it non-addicted, you know, to the point of T790M at diagnosis, and I think Tom will be interested because the work's come out from MGH on this. I have a case here that I talked about earlier. We have a patient who presented with BAC. She was a non-smoker with 2 sites of disease. Both of them were bronchoalveolar carcinoma, 49 years old, otherwise healthy. And we just did EGFR mutation sequencing. She had an L858R mutation and a concurrent T790M, obviously never exposed before. The interesting twist on this is when we asked her family history, she said, oh yeah, my father also died of lung cancer. He was also a non-smoker, and her paternal grandfather was also a non-smoker. So we're now in the process of getting germline sequencing, and we suspect this may be another one of the T790M germline mutations.
Yeah. Dan Haber had described a case like that.
That's right.
Vince, off study, what would you be doing?
So my algorithm is, do we have tissue? If yes, does the patient have a mutation? If yes, then erlotinib or erlotinib chemo or kitchen sink first line.
What would you generally prefer of those three?
In the mutation patient, I would usually start with erlotinib alone.
Erlotinib alone. Okay. Now let's go into adenocarcinoma, not eligible for BEV study, hemoptysis. Tony, what's your general approach to a patient like that?
Well, I think any of the combinations, not including bevacizumab, of course, are acceptable.
How about cetuximab?
I wouldn't argue against it, but I don't feel strongly about using the drug right now in front line.
Okay, so now let's talk about adenocarcinoma, theoretically eligible for BEV, and we'll get into the choice and also the issue of maintenance. So, Mark, in general, what would you do with a patient like that, including, as things move out towards the maintenance part, and what would you be okay with?
So my thinking is, what's the best chemotherapy? And in this case, you're going to think about adding BEV because it's BEV eligible. And so I think the FDA approved choice is carboplatin BEV, but I've treated a number of these patients with carbopemetrexed BEV, and I've typically give 4 cycles and then continue just the BEV portion of it as a so-called prolonged duration or maintenance therapy.
So would you say that's sort of your general approach, or maybe carboplatin BEV also equal?
Probably 50-50, in terms of what we use. It depends on the patient and comorbidities, and there's some patients that aren't great taxane candidates and that kind of thing. We also may swing a little bit more toward carboplatin. We have a number of clinical trials in the second line setting that are PEM-based, and so if you're exposed to PEM up front, you're not eligible for these trials, so that's what we tend to do.
I think in adenocarcinoma, the trend, and I agree with this, is to use pemetrexed with a platinum.
And BEV.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then my question is, okay, well, then what happens afterwards, this maintenance thing? What would you generally do and what would you be okay with? Let's say, Tony, you're talking about carbo-PEM-BEV. What is your general longer-term strategy going to be?
I'm using mixed data here. I would probably use the therapy for 4 courses. Then I would use Alimta perhaps for 4 more.
With or without BEV?
With BEV. And then stop pemetrexed after 4 courses and continue the BEV out for a total of a year.
Tapering strategy.
Tapered.
So, Mark, the patient's gotten this as a first opinion. You're okay with it?
I'm okay.
What else would you be okay with, again, in terms of the longer-term strategy, and somebody starts out with carbo-PEM, and if the first opinion was, let's just stop everything, would you be okay with that?
I personally would be okay. I may be in the minority here. I still think that we have had discussions with a number of patients that ask the question, how much is prolonged BEV going to help me? And so we have stopped BEV, always continue it until progression. So I personally would be okay with that. I don't know how other people feel. If Dr. Sandler were here, he'd be coming across the table at me.
Suppose, Rogerio, the first opinion was, okay, they've gotten carbo, PEM, BEV. Now they want to just go to PEM without BEV.
I would feel a little uncomfortable with that. I mean, I wouldn't say, your doctor doesn't know what he's doing, but I would feel a little uncomfortable. I would rather have the BEV continued with or without the pemetrexed.
And I think the trend, the practice pattern is most people, unless there's a contraindication, are giving maintenance BEV, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's increased.
Yeah.
What about the patient who gets carboplatin BEV? Again, what are you thinking sort of longer-term strategy, Vince?
Well, I've generally followed the 45-99 paradigm and continued the BEV in selected patients, say, who remain symptomatic, and I thought I could target their symptoms. I certainly could envision adding in either erlotinib or pemetrexed based on clinical features or molecular features. So that was sort of what Nasser's discussion was about in part at ASCO. I think the patients who remain with tumor-related symptoms after your initial chemo are those, at least in my mind, whom I might consider bringing in a new agent or agents.
And I think that's really what it comes down to, that at the end of the day, we're going to have to use clinical judgment. You have the option to give patients a treatment break, and at that point, it's going to come down to where the patient is at the end of those initial 4 cycles, and then what maintenance strategy you choose, again, depends on clinical and molecular features, but I don't think it's a yes, all patients or even most patients need to be on maintenance, and no, I wouldn't give maintenance to anybody because the data is not convincing. I think it gives us additional options, and you just have to work with your patient.
And there's a new ECOG trial that's going to address those questions.
Exactly.
And it's a carboplatin bevacizumab treatment, I think, for 4 to 6 cycles. And then the patients are randomized to bevacizumab alone, bevacizumab combined with pemetrexed.
And pemetrexed alone.
And I believe pemetrexed alone.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's going to be an extremely informative study because we're in the danger that every new treatment just gets piled on top of each other. And well, actually, in the absence of information, I think the kitchen sink approach that Vince was talking about before can have a place in specific circumstances, but you'd like to find out, should we just be adding those now? So I typically follow the ECOG 4599 paradigm, as Vince mentioned before, with the carbo, paclitaxel, and then Bev maintenance, Bev with chemo and Bev maintenance. But after the JMEN data, it's a very interesting question now about whether or not to add pemetrexed and bevacizumab as maintenance in good-performing patients who are able to tolerate it. You know, we do have randomized phase 2 data in the second-line setting with either docetaxel or pemetrexed with or without bevacizumab. This is a randomized phase 2 by Roy Herbst and colleagues that favored, it had a trend favoring, at least for progression-free survival, the addition of bevacizumab to either of those chemo drugs. So we were talking before about it's not really maintenance. You could see it as early second line versus late second line. And if you view this as second early line, we have randomized phase 2 data that would argue in favor of pemetrexed and bevacizumab instead of just bevacizumab.
I mean, the one counter argument there is that was in Bev naive patients in that setting. So, you know, I think the paradigm of 4599 was great 4 years ago. You know, it was much simpler then. I think all the data that we've seen from the so-called maintenance trials call into question about what is the best thing to do after you finish your primary treatment. You know, just because ECOG 4599 was done with bevacizumab to progression doesn't mean that that's the best thing in every patient. And my fear is that we're kind of evolving into the Herceptin model, where it seems like once you're on Herceptin, you're on Herceptin forever. And when I hear people saying we're continuing Bev, we're adding to it and all that kind of stuff, how much this is expensive therapy in an incurable disease.
To me, there's a logical issue with pemetrexed that we haven't really talked about. And Mark always says maintenance and sort of puts it in quotes, and I agree with that. I mean, if you get a non-pemetrexed combination and you're responding or even stable and you only get 4 cycles, what's wrong with just saying, well, the therapy needs to be 8 cycles, 4 more pemetrexed? That's therapy. That's the total picture. Right. And then after you're there, you can make a decision to rest the patient. Yeah. You see, I mean, to me, that makes more sense than to have to struggle over these decisions after 4 treatments, saying, well, 30% of the patients never get treated in second line. Well, just go ahead and use pemetrexed. It's an easy drug to use.
Is this really clinically meaningful, though? I mean, you know, you're talking about a desperate situation with people who are, if they're not going downhill, are about to go downhill, very short survivals. I mean, do you think that this really means anything at a human level in terms of what people might gain from this?
Well, I do. I mean, I was impressed more so with the pemetrexed data. When you look at the curves, particularly in the right histology, these are pretty impressive curves, both for PFS as well as overall survival. So I think that's pretty meaningful. And some of our statisticians are trying to take all this data that we have now and put it into a model that if every lung cancer patient in the United States got the 3 lines of FDA-approved therapy with the current data we have about the impact on PFS and overall survival, what would the lung cancer survival curve look like if everyone got exposed to these active agents?
What would it look like in 18 months?
Well, I can't tell you that yet, but that's what they're...
Well, the British would agree that you shouldn't do it. I mean, they don't approve it. The Canadians don't approve bevacizumab. The British don't approve it in lung cancer. So I do believe that we're helping these patients, and the data would support it. But what is the magnitude of it? Well, it's a little bit each... Yeah. Get another step here, another step there. It starts adding up.
What about the combination of erlotinib and Bev, Vince? Again, I see lots of docs doing this outside a protocol setting. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, my feeling is in general that bevacizumab is not going to take a patient who's intrinsically resistant to erlotinib and make them sensitive to it, but it will enhance the subset of patients who are sensitive, both vis-a-vis the magnitude of their response and probably their progression. And I think that's borne out in part if you look at the forest plots from Beta Lung or Atlas, that the patients who seem to do best, you know, absent molecular markers, were the never smokers. And so I'm actually a big fan of the trial that Tom had rejected and that CALGB is planning to look at AT, erlotinib, bevacizumab, in sort of the hypersensitive patient population. I think it's well tolerated. I don't think there's any toxicities that are independent of those known for each component agent. And I think it's a very reasonable thing in certain venues.
So I think actually, Ron, I brought that up because I think it's kind of a lead in to talk about vandetanib in terms of the fact that, you know, both of those mechanisms are out on the table for that agent. And in the long run, are we going to be looking at agents that can hit multiple pathways? We asked you and also John to review a couple of the data sets that have been presented recently on the drug. But can we start just by talking a little bit, maybe both of you can kind of talk about how it works and what we know about its mechanism of action?
Well, vandetanib is a once-a-day oral agent that has both EGFR receptor and VEGFR receptor inhibitory properties. Compared to erlotinib or gefitinib, its EGFR receptor inhibitory properties are a little more modest. But it's a fairly potent VEGFR 1 and 2 inhibitor, and it also happens to be a potent inhibitor, as are a lot of the anti-angiogenic tyrosine kinase inhibitor, of RET kinase, which is important in some thyroid malignancies.
And John, one of the things that's kind of been interesting I've observed from the outside is the change in how it works based on the dose. Can you comment on that?
Sure. Well, you know, as Ron had mentioned, it's more potent for VEGF receptor than EGF receptor. And we don't have the perfect answer for what dose corresponds to what, but at least when we do modeling and we look at the side effects, it looks at full dose at 300 milligrams, which is essentially what we consider the MTD, and that's what Ron's study was done at. It has real EGFR inhibitor activity. That's where we see acneiform rash and so forth. In addition to VEGF receptor inhibitory activity, at lower doses, at 100 milligrams, it looks like we're mainly getting VEGF inhibitory activity with some hypertension and some other biomarker changes, but we're seeing very little of the EGFR inhibitory activity. And I think that's relevant for the chemotherapy combinations, because when we compared in the phase 2 setting a lower dose versus the higher dose, the lower dose combined better with chemotherapy, which potentially made sense in this setting in the context of the earlier findings that full-dose EGFR inhibition did not combine well with chemotherapy, if you look at the TALENT and INTACT studies. So at least the way I think about it is at lower dose, we may be getting more VEGF or more of a pure VEGF inhibitor. At higher doses, you may be getting a comparable inhibition of both.
And any thoughts about what's happening there with this agent compared, for example, John, if you're looking at the combination of Bev and erlotinib as an example? Yeah. Of course, obviously the Bev's outside the cell, sure. But what do we know about that?
Well, we don't have a direct comparison between them. I think erlotinib is a more potent EGFR inhibitor than vandetanib is. It's hard to compare an antibody like bevacizumab with vandetanib in terms of VEGF inhibitory activity. But what we can say, if you take it in pieces, we can say that patients with EGFR mutants, and Ron can also talk about this, have responses to vandetanib. So that says that like other EGFR inhibitors like erlotinib and gefitinib, it has EGFR inhibitor activity. And unlike bevacizumab, where in the second-line setting we haven't seen single-agent responses, we do see tumor shrinkage. That tells us it's different than a pure VEGF inhibitor. But unlike an EGFR inhibitor, we see enhancement with chemotherapy, which we don't see with pure EGFR inhibitors. So we're seeing some of the properties of both VEGF and EGFR inhibitors.
So, Ron, can you talk about the two studies I wanted you to talk about?
Well, we tried to address the question that John raises about this drug that targets two different receptors. Does it actually do that in patients? And we designed a randomized phase 2 trial in which patients in the second or third line setting were randomized to receive gefitinib, Iressa, or vandetanib. And this was a blinded trial. And the initial response and stable disease rate was a bit higher with the vandetanib than it was with the gefitinib, with the Iressa. At the time of progression, remembering this is a blinded trial, when patients progressed in either arm of the study, they underwent a washout period and crossed over, switched to the alternate therapy.
This is blinded?
That's the way the trial was designed. Patients who received Iressa first, gefitinib first, when they switched over to vandetanib, the percent of patients that had some clinical benefit measured as response or stable disease was a bit higher than patients who received vandetanib first and crossed over to gefitinib. So what that told us, at least in theory, is that after exposure to gefitinib, under which circumstances you, quote, exhaust EGFR sensitivity of the tumor, and exhausted in terms of cancer is actually progressing, vandetanib still retains some apparent efficacy. The opposite was not true. When patients first received vandetanib and cancer progressed, when they crossed over to gefitinib, the amount of benefit was really quite marginal. So it did help us think that vandetanib does in fact have dual action, actions that perhaps could be exploited as a single agent given at full dose, or combined with chemotherapy at a lower dose in which it loses that EGFR inhibitory action and it has only its VEGFR inhibitory action that may be complementary with chemotherapy.
Do we know anything about vandetanib in patients with EGFR mutations?
We have very little data. John, you may be aware of more of the data, but the objective response rate appears to be fairly high.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, preliminary data suggests that it's on the same order of magnitude as with an EGFR inhibitor in terms of response, perhaps slightly lower. This was data that was presented at ASCO the past year. And in our first-line trial, we only had a handful of patients for which we had EGFR mutations detected that got monotherapy, but it was on the order of 3 patients, and all of them had prolonged responses consistent with what you'd see with an EGFR inhibitor.
And Tom, what do we know about the, I don't even know if we have the data on this, in terms of the necessary dose or blood level you have to have with an EGFR TKI in EGFR mutation patients?
I think we think that you can get away with less, dramatically less drug. We know from preclinical modeling that you can get away with a lot less drug, which is one of the reasons I think that most of us feel so comfortable using gefitinib in EGFR mutants. But just to comment on John's point, I agree. I've seen responses to vandetanib in EGFR mutants. So I think that there's reasons to think that it's not a terrible drug in that setting.
Tom, when you know that someone has a sensitivity mutation, EGFR, and you're going to use erlotinib, do you start at full dose erlotinib?
But to be very honest with you, if gefitinib was on the market here, I would use gefitinib in that patient population.
But you're not tempted to start with 50?
No, I mean, I think that most people tolerate erlotinib okay, but I think, you know, why not? You know, the one thing I used to say when the mutation study came out, you could probably take a dose of erlotinib or gefitinib, divide it up into 7 little pieces and give it to someone every day for 7 days, and they'd probably do okay. But I have not been dose modifying.
Can you talk a little bit more about those 2 studies, though?
Yeah. So there were important randomized phase 3 trials that were presented at ASCO this year. One was a head-to-head randomized blinded comparison of vandetanib versus erlotinib in 1,240 patients, and it was a worldwide trial. The results indicated no differences in the 2 arms of the trial with respect to response rate, progression-free survival, or overall survival. So on the one hand, one could say, well, vandetanib performed as well as erlotinib did in this second, occasionally third-line setting. On the other hand, one could also say it's a little disappointing given the results of the beta trial in which combined EGFR and anti-angiogenic actions at least improved progression-free survival with a bit of a trend towards an improvement in overall survival. This did not quite match that mark. Different setting, much larger study, phase 3 trial. And this trial used what we call full-dose vandetanib, 300 milligrams per day. The second phase 3 trial that was presented by Roy Herbst and colleagues was a randomized trial of docetaxel combined with placebo or docetaxel combined with vandetanib at 100 milligrams a day, the dose in which we would get presumably only VEGFR inhibition. And this was a large trial in over 1,300 patients. And again, there was a statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival, the primary endpoint of the study, with at least a trend towards an improvement in overall survival, although the difference was not statistically significant.
What was seen in both of those studies in terms of side effects and toxicity?
Side effects were, as we would expect, with docetaxel, with erlotinib, and with what we saw with vandetanib in the phase 2 trial, in which we see some skin toxicity at the 300 milligram per day dose. We see a little bit of hypertension.
Proteinuria?
Proteinuria was really uncommon. We did not see severe anti-angiogenic class side effects and no significant pulmonary hemorrhage. In fact, no one died of pulmonary hemorrhage. Combined with docetaxel, there is an increment in toxicity compared to docetaxel alone because you are adding a little bit of the skin rash, a little bit of the anti-angiogenic side effects to docetaxel, but at least with an improvement in progression-free survival. There was a third study that was presented, same trial design as the docetaxel study, but in this case using pemetrexed plus or minus vandetanib, that again showed an improvement in progression-free survival, but no improvement in overall survival.
And John, you were going to comment, that's the ZEAL study. Any thoughts about that?
No, I agree with everything that Ron just laid out. And I'd like to point out a couple of interesting parts of the biomarker analyses that came out of the study, particularly the ZEAL study. So while erlotinib and vindetinib were equal, the hazard ratio was just slightly below 1 for progression-free survival, the groups of patients who were responding actually appeared to be a little bit different. So actually, if you had KRAS mutations, there was a trend towards improvement in the vindetinib arm, whereas patients with EGFR mutations did slightly better on the erlotinib arm. So this suggested, and if I had somebody who came in and could choose between the two, if they had an EGFR mutation, I would treat them with their erlotinib first. But actually, patients with KRAS mutations did better with the dual inhibition. And I'll point out that we had published a paper in mouse models of lung cancer where we tested different EGFR TKI-resistant models, and it turned out that in KRAS models, that was a case where dual inhibition made a big difference. If you had an EGFR mutation, as Tom raised before, it was so sensitive it didn't make a difference as long as you had an EGFR TKI, it worked. But in the case of KRAS, dual inhibition was more important. So we'll have to see how the full data comes out from that study, but it at least gives a hint that if you're choosing between EGFR TKIs and if vindetinib were approved, this might tilt you towards vindetinib in patients, for example, with KRAS mutations or other patients that wouldn't classically respond to erlotinib.
How about the paper you published in the JCO looking at vindetinib with paclitaxel carbo?
Yeah. So that was a randomized phase 2 design, and this was 181 patients total. It was three arms. And three arms were vindetinib, carboplatin, paclitaxel, or carboplatin, paclitaxel, and vindetinib combined, the three drugs together. Now, unfortunately, we didn't have the earlier data suggesting the 100 milligrams worked better with chemotherapy, and we actually did this with the 300 milligram dose, which was the maximum tolerated dose. And a couple of interesting things from this study. We had an early interim analysis, and at the interim analysis, it was found that vindetinib monotherapy was actually inferior to chemotherapy in unselected patients. And this is reminiscent of Rogerio's study with an EGFR TKI versus chemotherapy that had very comparable results, and also from IPASS. So I think all of those studies tell us together that in the absence of an EGFR mutation or in unselected patients, chemotherapy is still better than an EGFR TKI. We don't have a rationale for selecting just a TKI alone. However, in patients with EGFR mutations, they did extremely well with just vindetinib monotherapy. The three-drug combination, vindetinib, carboplatin, paclitaxel, did a little bit better than carboplatin, paclitaxel. The hazard ratio was 0.76, which is, you know, sort of in the range of what we're seeing in these other combination studies, sort of a moderate improvement. When we looked at the median, there wasn't a big difference in the median progression-free survival. It was about 24 versus 23 weeks, but there appeared to be a small group of patients that were really on the tail of the curve that had prolonged benefit from the three-drug combination. So I'd say overall, in the unselected population, it's not a dramatic result there, a small amount of improvement when you're adding the full dose, but in a subset of patients, they did get a substantial benefit. One last thing I'll point out is we've been looking at blood markers to see if we could predict who benefits from one or the other of the drugs. And the first observation from this and several of the other phase 2 studies was that VEGF levels alone, patients with low VEGF got more benefit from the addition of vindetinib than patients with high VEGF. And so we were eager to see if this holds up across all of the different studies, but this at least gives us the hint that plasma markers might be useful. And putting together a more complicated signature with multiple blood markers, we actually could predict different groups that were going to get larger degrees of benefit from chemotherapy as well. And we think that's a promising method moving forward because it's something that can be done routinely in patients in a non-invasive way. So we're looking at that in a number of studies. So I think the bottom line is in unselected patients, vindetinib was inferior, but we certainly saw groups of patients that did better. And the three-drug combination was modestly better than the two-drug combination.
So, Ron, what other data sets are we waiting for with this agent? Where do you think it's heading? Do you think it's going to be approved?
Well, there's a third-line, fourth-line placebo-controlled trial that's in progress. It's nearing completion. So it's a randomized trial of vindetinib versus placebo. And my prediction is that FDA approval is going to be dependent on that study achieving a positive outcome. It probably should. I think in patients who make it out to the third, fourth line setting, who still have good performance status, even when we look at the erlotinib and the gefitinib data and other data, that some treatment appears to benefit a little bit compared to no treatment. So it may be that this drug will be approved at some point in the future, if that's a positive study by the FDA, and allow us to do more of these very important biomarker studies that John talked about.
Tom, where do you think this is heading?
So one question I would to answer and also throw out a question. I worry now, or I wonder, if the economy and the move to healthcare reform is not going to cause us to look differently at drug approvals. Now, I think that cetuximab and vandetanib fall into very similar. I looked at those curves, and I blinked twice and thought I was looking at the cetuximab curve from Flex. I mean, what you're seeing from both these curves is you're seeing a drug that has a very marginal benefit, but a real benefit from these studies, well done, phase three trials. But we haven't yet figured out which patients are benefiting. And I would argue that the tide is sort of turning a little bit in society toward really starting to question the expenditures on health. And I wonder if physicians are going to start to concern themselves with cost of care more, so that I think a drug like cetuximab or a drug like vandetanib is in a slightly difficult situation now, which it might not have been 3-4 years ago before there was this focus as we go forward.
I think you're raising an incredibly important point. And I think as we talk more and more about targeted drugs, I think it's going to be incumbent that we identify the targeted population who benefits.
And only treat them.
Yeah. And I did some today, and I agree with your comments as well. But so one of the things we have to ask, is there some need that's being filled that isn't being filled right now? And I think you can say in the case, as an example here, for the vandetanib with docetaxel combination, well, if it's a TKI that adds benefit to chemotherapy, and there was actually symptom improvement overall, and when they looked at the time to deterioration of symptoms in that study, there was actually a pretty dramatic improvement. There was less nausea and so forth. You've got a drug now that can be used in the squamous cell setting. So all patients with squamous cell carcinoma and all histologies, rather, were treated. And right now, we don't have an angiogenesis inhibitor that can be used in the setting of squamous cell carcinoma. We don't have an oral angiogenesis inhibitor that's been shown to add benefit to chemotherapy as it's been added here. And as monotherapy, you've got a drug that potentially could provide benefit in resistant populations like those with KRAS. So now, if all those findings do hold up, I think that says this is a drug that could fulfill an unmet need as having an oral angiogenesis inhibitor in other populations.
I agree with all those points.
What's BIBW1120 and how does that compare to vandetanib?
Sure. So BIBW1120 is another one of the multi-targeted kinase inhibitors that inhibits VEGF receptor, but it's a little different than some of the ones we've talked about before because it inhibits the FGF receptor pathway in addition to VEGF receptors. And this is an interesting profile because a lot of the tyrosine kinase inhibitors we have, like sunitinib, will inhibit VEGF receptors and PDGF receptor, but they rarely hit the FGF receptor pathway. And we think that the FGF receptor pathway is an important escape mechanism when you block VEGF. We're presenting a study at the World Lung about how in bevacizumab resistance in preclinical models, the FGF receptor pathway can rise up and overcome that resistance. So the possibility, or at least having the option to block the FGF receptor pathway, is an appealing one.
What about the issue of, you know, everybody's looking for predictors of response. We talked a lot about EGFR. What about anti-angiogenics? And there was a paper looking at SNPs and ASCO and Bev. We've seen the same thing in breast cancer. You know, are we anywhere near, if you look at the VEGF or the side of the vandetanib equation or Bev, in trying to figure out who might respond?
We're not at the level we're ready to use this clinically yet, but I think what's important is to make sure we design the studies so that we have the potential to get there if they are good markers. And I think that's an important point, is to make sure we're looking, and they won't make it to prime time if we're not looking. You know, I think there's very strong and intriguing trends seen from the earlier studies that certainly mean that they should be investigated thoroughly in the phase threes. The phase three vandetanib results aren't fully analyzed yet, but it certainly looks like the trend is holding up strongly in one of the studies and not the other, holding up in Ron Natale's
For VEGF
study,
levels or SNPs?
For VEGF levels.
For VEGF
yeah,
levels.
The
SNP
serum
levels
are, VEGF levels or on the tumor?
Serum VEGF levels. Now, I'll point out that biomarkers are more difficult for angiogenesis inhibitors than they are for a lot of others because here we're not targeting the tumor. So
exactly.
You can't just look at EGFR or tumor mutations. We're targeting everything that's floating around in the blood that's driving angiogenesis. We're targeting normal endothelial cells, so you can't look for somatic mutations. So I think markers that are, first of all, non-invasive, I think blood is a fruitful place to look for them. And then I think germline polymorphisms will certainly impact it. And there's some nice work from a breast cancer Eastern Cooperative Group Oncology study by Schneider and colleagues that VEGF SNPs, polymorphisms, variations of the VEGF gene, may be predictive. So while none of this is ready for prime time, I think we've got enough intriguing preliminary data that it's certainly worth a thorough examination.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special Think Tank edition of Lung Cancer Update.